there are three good reasons for this young guy not to work on this Bilderberg topic on his final papers. First reason, if he is interested in a career as a political scientist, this career will be ended before it just began, because I would have worked on this Bilderberg topic. Second, as billions are somehow handled at Bilderberg, and as they would decide on peace and war, he will not find out anything about Bilderberg, so there's no good reason to work on something you will not find out anything about. And third reason not to work on Bilderberg is, if I would find out something, I would have to cope with personal problems. So I was, like, shocked. I knew there would be a kind of a conspiracy theory around Bilderberg. But to hear this from a professor was like a shock, and I screamed at him and said, well, you are the director at the Institute in Hamburg on peace and security research, which is not just some institute in the world, it's one of the top five institutes in the world. And you've never heard until Friday, when I asked you for Bilderberg, you've never heard about Bilderberg before. And now, on Monday, you just say that Egon Barth said they would decide on peace and war at these conferences. And you've never heard about Bilderberg before. And now I ask you, are you serious? Who is paying you for your research work, as you don't even know that Bilderberg exists and where peace and war is done? And I was screaming, and in the middle of the sentence, my voice broke off, and he recognized this moment, and now he screamed at me and said, you blue-eyed asshole, do you really believe, you naive asshole, do you really believe the American president, he is voted? Are you serious? Where do you live? Where do you live? I said, that's where we are? Oh yes, that's where we are!
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday the 9th of June 2023. Streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokescroft Arts Centre in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream. And at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey. Also live on our glorious app, that is the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores. Please, though, don't use Google. Don't use the Google Play Store. There's always somewhere better than there. And, for example, with the Telegram app, Google messes about with it before you're allowed to download it from there. So use another. And if you need one, just go to our show page at thisweek.org.uk. There's links to another one there. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade psyops at the moment. In the old days, it was smearing at the 30 pence a pill ivermectin COVID treatment, which could have saved, according to Dr. Tess Laurie, and we'll be hearing a bit more from her in a minute, around about 60,000 lives here in Britain. So thanks very much to the mainstream press for saying that ivermectin's horse dewormer. Actually, no, it's a very cheap treatment for COVID, particularly early COVID, which could have saved 60,000 lives. So doesn't that, not that that bothers them. So also we have an accelerationist cult effectively waging war on the British people now, as well as on Russia too. Anyone like to sign my little petition here with your name and address to join the British Army to go and fight Russia? Well, don't hold your breath. So anyway, this is what the BBC might sound like if it were free of the tentacles of the deep state lobbies. And navigating us through the Fourth Reich Matrix this week, or the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and also it's researcher on all sorts of things, but today we're talking about fake news, Dr. Judith Brown. Obviously, we'll be looking at some of the basic stuff this week. Trump just been announced that Trump is being indicted again. There's all sorts of mud being thrown at Trump and Boris to try and stop them being electable, obviously. And apparently he's been stealing state secrets. So maybe the whole trial will be a complete waste of time. And funny, isn't it, that Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, still hasn't been put on trial for all the corruption in Ukraine, etc. Also, we've got wildfires over in Canada. And, of course, we'll be looking at the dam, the big dam that's burst, apparently. Actually, the real dam that's burst is the fact that the offensive launched by Ukraine has been a total failure. I don't know if you've heard this, Martin. Kill ratio is around about 40 to 1. But anyway, we'd be turning about, that is to say, 40 Ukrainians dying for every one Russian. Not exactly something to put in the news, but of course you can put a dam in the news. That's another thing to do to cover it up. We'd be also interesting if we get time to talk a bit about Kosovo, Martin, because things are hotting up there too. But we'll start with you, Judith, and start on the main story, really, is that you've been, in fact, you were on the UK column talking about this recently. To do with fake news, but actually it's really about the fact checkers, because we've seen this with, particularly with this new BBC Verify. The amount of trust, opinion polls tell us, in the mainstream press in Britain has hit an all-time low. So rather than actually start telling the truth, the mainstream press seem to have been employing these fact-checkers of various sorts to say, well, this is true and this isn't.
Absolutely. It's quite interesting, the Verify programme. I think this is to try and protect the BBC's reputation because, as you know, I think the Press Gazette said that in the last 4 years that its ratings have gone down 20%, its approval rating. So I think that they're trying to do a catch-up. But my work has been specifically surrounding fact checkers, and I've been looking at
You're fact checking the fact checkers?
Yes, indeed. Okay. And so far I've found around 500 groups all over the world, but there's a lot more than that, Tony, because, for example, there's a group called PISA Check in Africa, and it says that it networks with 174 fact-checking newsrooms, and I haven't been able to find any of those as far as I know. And in UK, there's a relatively small number. And bear in mind that nearly all of the media, from the local media to the mainstream media, have got fact-check departments. So I haven't located many of those. I have located some, like the BBC's Reality Check and now Verify. But we've actually got a lot more than that. I think it's probably in terms of many thousands worldwide. The range is just incredible. They advertise for fact checkers in minority languages, for example. In Africa and India, there's fact check groups that fact check maybe in 9-10 languages, and there's many of those. Every European language is fact checked. And everything as well. It's not just social media, which is what I thought it was, but the fact checking extends to mainstream news. That means radio, television, and also newspapers. It extends to online games. If you remember, someone was caught out posting some information on an online games group, online games website in America, and you might think, well, how do they do that? They actually have fact checkers on online games groups. So everything, as well as all forms of social media, it's all fact checked. So the extent of this fact check network is just phenomenal, unbelievable.
It's posting it on a games website. I mean, I think, isn't this related to the Ukraine war?
Yes.
Martin, do you know anything about that? You're nodding
the
away.
There's a young guy who's in the Air Force, and he was using his credentials to download, classified material, which apparently he then was posting online on this online games forum, as you say.
Yeah.
Of course, I've been reading a lot about this, and it's not even clear that this is he is really the guilty party. It may be that this is some kind of factional fight going on.
It could also be somebody spoofing his account or hacking into his account.
Well, no, I mean, it looks as if the first lot of stuff was genuine, and he was arrested for that, and I think he's being charged with various things. But then the mainstream media then picked up on that and said that they've been given other information by people that they can't name, all of which turns out, basically to be saying Russia's losing the war, because the stuff that came out was saying that they were winning, which is why it was of importance in terms of perceptions and all the rest of it. And, in other words, the internal Pentagon discussion was, we're not winning this, which, of course, is this significant political point behind it all.
So interesting that someone should choose to use a games site to put this stuff out, almost like hopefully the authorities wouldn't be looking there. But anyway, the key thing, of course, to do with all of this is, I mean, I think most of us understand the fact checkers are there because actually every single journalist, every single editor should be a fact checker. Every single owner of the media really should be a fact checker. All these people should be making sure that if something goes through, say like, I don't know, the Hitler diaries did, whatever it was, 30, 40 years ago, that the people who didn't check their facts pay the price. They don't keep their jobs. But it seems to me something's changed. That you've got, it's almost understood that you don't really have to check the facts. And if there's any problem with it, the fact checkers will move in.
Absolutely. You're completely right. There's a completely different system of fact-checking now, and every journalist is encouraged to go through these new fact-checking procedures, which teaches them how to search, how to source, how to use fact-check tools, for example. So there's lots of these courses online. There's a fact-check group called Africa Check, and that says that it's trained 10,000 Africans in fact checking, most of whom presumably were journalists, although some may have been students, because they also focus on students too. It's all free. Most of it is paid for large groups like Meta and Google. Although a lot of fact check platforms actually operate courses, those courses are not funded by the fact check platforms themselves. They're funded by a bigger organisations. And
sorry, what big organisations?
Well, things like Google and Meta, the IFCN funds some. So they're just large corporations.
And, well, this is interesting, Martin. Let me bring you in again here, because there is a lot of evidence that these big social media firms are actually very tight with the intelligence services. We're talking about the Facebooks of this world, etc., and Google particularly.
Well, I think that, as you say, Tony, all journalists ought to be fact checkers. I mean, that just goes without saying, really, doesn't it? This is an attempt to control cyberspace by the deep state, because they're quite freaked out by it. It ran out of control as far as they were concerned. So what they're doing now is they're trying, and they don't just take down stuff that they don't like or finger it out. They also put stuff up there which is deliberately disinformational. So we're living, you know, propaganda has become a kind of massive industry. It always was, but it's, you know, it's in your face really these days, isn't it?
Going back to the grey zone, we were talking about this last week briefly with Alex Craner. The troubling questions surround the BBC disinformation correspondent Mariana Spring. Now, this seems to be, I mean, certainly emails by Paul Mason. I mean, but many people remember Paul Mason as the Newsnight economics correspondent, Martin, and he actually did a very good job. But now it seems that he's found a role in identifying people who are not in support of the NATO war against Russia in Ukraine, and attempting at least to shut them down, take them down.
Yeah. I mean, what he's...
How does he go from being Newsnight guy to this almost like policeman of the information?
He's an ambiguous character, is the truth of the matter. I used to quite like some of his stuff, and I've read some of his books. But the Ukraine war, he's been very, very pro the NATO line. And not only that, he's gone out of his way talking to people he knows in MI6, and he knows they're MI6 people, about how they can discredit what he calls the rogue academics and journalists. In other words, the people that aren't going along with the mainstream line. And these emails between him and this MI6 officer were leaked to the Grey Zone. And I think Kit Clarenberg was pulled in by the police when he came back from Serbia the other day, on the basis that the Russians had hacked these leaks, these emails out. But of course the Grey Zone's line is, somebody gave us these emails because they wanted to expose Mason's skullduggery. Because of course it doesn't look at all good for Mason to have a, 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 personal vendetta against David Miller, who was a professor here at Bristol.
That's right. I mean, we've got the same thing going on with Prince Harry this week in his phone hacking trial, similar anyway. He's saying all this stuff was hacked. Well, actually, it's quite feasible that somebody just was either paid by a journalist who was close to him that knew about whatever it was, just hands the information over, or else they feel that it's in the public interest to give something to the journalists on him. It's very difficult to actually, you know, to say this has been hacked. But that's actually what Paul Mason has been saying, that this information has been hacked. Well, no, maybe just somebody who was getting your email decided to pass it on. But look, just going back again to Marianna Spring, I find her a fascinating character. I find her a bit, when I see her on TV, I think, do I trust you? She's being all sort of sincere, and I'm going to tell you what's really going on. Trust me. And I'm always a little bit suspicious, because we say on this show, don't trust us. Go and check the facts for yourself. She's saying the opposite. Beyond her education, this is Kit Clarenberg, who was arrested last week's work on her. She did her education at Oxford University's Pembroke College. She studied at Oxford during the period where disgraced former MI6 chief Richard Dearlove served as its master. He was the guy in charge of MI6 during the Iraq War, for example, and on the fake intelligence around the Iraq War, the weapons of mass destruction. So she would maybe well have known him. While there, she spent an extended period in Russia, working for the Western-funded Moscow Times. So if you ever want the Western view on Russia, go to the Moscow Times website. She was working there. Her LinkedIn profile has been cached by Internet Archive very few times since its creation, suggesting that certain captures may have been scrubbed by request. Well, this is something that you can request if you wish. If you want, you can write to the Internet Archive saying, I don't want these captures because something embarrassing might have been on there. There's little doubt, says Clarenberg, about Spring's online footprint elsewhere has been subjected to a dedicated cleanup operation. One of the most prolific editors of her Wikipedia page is the mysterious Philip Cross, a notorious troll whose fanatical dedication to vandalising the entries of anti-war, anti-imperialist public figures while whitewashing and beautifying those of establishment shills and deep state actors is prolific. That's been acknowledged by the mainstream press. So this woman, Marianna Spring, it's almost as if, Judith, she is not trustworthy even before she's opened her mouth.
Well, certainly, I think that the people who were not following the COVID narrative saw her as a bit of a fool. She didn't seem to understand anything about the COVID narrative, and I think that she did upset a lot of people. I think she does say that she had a lot of online abuse, and I think that's certainly possible. Some people were very upset. All of us have had online abuse. I mean, you know, you and I have too. So because we have a different.
I think if you're a public figure, it's almost par for the course. The other thing, of course, is you can just simply press a button and get a load of bots to online abuse you if you want to be portrayed as a victim.
Yes.
So, you know, this is the problem. Apparently, Elon Musk is trying to clear up with Twitter. When he first arrived, whenever it was, 3 or 4 months ago, he was saying, hey guys, first thing I found was that something like 1/5 of the users on Twitter were actually bots, and we knew that, and then we just turned them off, shut them down. So you know, that I'm not saying I'm a big fan of Elon Musk at all, but it was interesting to hear that so much of what goes on there is literally you press a button on a computer and some little bit of AI software somewhere makes up some nasty insult and starts slinging it at a target. So you know, it's not necessarily a person behind that. Anyway, look, the key thing with fact checking is the broad spectrum of funding. Now, you've talked a bit about Facebook and Google doing that. What influence do the funders have? Because we just want to know where the money's coming from for this whole new industry.
Yeah, the money, some of it comes from government sources, Western government sources, only Western government sources. And that either is paid directly through Foreign Office or from the Defence Department or whatever. Some of it is paid through organisations like, for example, the European Endowment Fund in Europe or the German Marshall Fund, National Endowment Fund in America. There's also masses of very wealthy foundations, the Asia Foundation, which initially was started by the CIA, but I don't think it's all CIA now, but it's got those links. Then there's other big organizations. Bill Gates tends to fund fact-checking in Africa only. He doesn't fund anywhere else, but the Open Society funds everywhere.
So this is George Soros?
Yeah, George Soros. And then Ahmed Jar Foundation and Luminate, they're linked to eBay. There's the Craig Newmark Foundation linked to Craigslist in America, and the Craig Newmark is also linked to the Poynter Institute and the International Federation of Fact Checkers.
Okay, so who are these people? Where are these people coming from politically? Because obviously they're not just funding this out of the goodness of their heart.
No, it's foolish to say that foundations are going to fund people that where they don't like what they're doing. So fact check platforms will go asking for money to people that they know are sympathetic to censoring media content in some way.
I mean, this is interesting in itself, Martin, isn't it? We've had on this programme lots and lots of times discussions about these foundations. They're actually not supposed to do any political work at all.
Well, they managed to get round that by claiming that it's all in for the benefit of humanity and so on and so forth.
Educational.
Yeah.
Education.
Yeah, but, I mean, if you look on fact-check platforms, they nearly always say that that they're protecting democracy and they're protecting free speech. But it does seem rather strange that one way of protecting free speech is actually to censor it. That, to me, I just feel that debate is an important part of democracy, and it's the fact-checkers that are stifling that debate. Not only, of course, debates in the public, but also debate between scientists who might have different views. And science has never been settled. Science has always been a debate. And if it isn't a debate, it isn't science, you know. So I think that that it should be that that people are allowed to have different opinions.
But surely fact checkers can actually open the debate up, particularly when you've got a media which is so one-sided. It's becoming less and less open, I think, you know, over the decades since I were a lad. We're seeing much more, you know, for example, because they don't have much money nowadays, you may well see exactly the same Press Association article in the Daily Mirror, in the Daily Express, even in the Telegraph, pretty much the same word for word. It's been cut and pasted from a wire service. So there isn't that much debate going on within the press itself. No. And so maybe the fact checkers are doing a good thing by opening that up and by saying, hang on a minute, you've not checked that properly.
But is that a good thing? You see, for example, there's an organisation in Europe to which which is funded by the European Union, I think, but it actually creates copy. Although it's a fact check group, the European news agencies belong to it. AFP, Swedish ones, I can't remember the name of it. DPA, the Austrian one. So they all belong to it. And what they do is to create copy, not only just written copy, but also videos, video clips. And then they send this out to all of the newspapers and television programs, so that all over the world, so that they say that they're giving a European perspective. Now, they're actually being paid to produce copy. This copy is ready fact-checked, because if you think of it, there's no major major news agency that isn't registered with the International Fact Check Network, which is part of the Poynter's Institute. All of them are registered, so they're all fact checking copy before it goes out. The most the AFP, the French news agency, is the most active in that respect. It's got so many fact check platforms itself. It's got 83 contracts with Facebook for fact checking.
Surely, I mean, that sort of process can be a censorship process. So if a journalist writes something that the fact checkers, so-called censors, don't like, then it just doesn't get published.
Absolutely. I think that, the fact-checking in newsrooms starts before the content goes out. And this is the difficulty, I think, and the reason why...
It starts, I think, before the articles get even commissioned by the editor. It's called self-censorship. Absolutely. That doesn't even start. But once it does start, then even if it does get through the gates, then someone is there to put another gate down in front to stop it running.
Yeah, absolutely. I think so. And then I think journalists get to know what they can and can't print. I did interview a journalist about content, and he, first of all, was trying to sort of like get articles printed. This is at the beginning of the COVID narrative, for example. He was trying to get articles printed that showed a different sort of perspective. And quite reasonable articles, like, for example, on numbers in hospitals and things that were later very well known. But he couldn't do this. And in the end, he was being sort of like mocked by the editor. So in the end, he sort of like he decided he would just leave that story alone, and he wouldn't touch anything to do with COVID because he knew that his job was at risk if he continued with it. So I think that yes, self-censorship is an important part of the program. And of course, I mean, right at the beginning, the fact checkers were there to fact check the BCFM, as you know, because as soon as you put something out, pressure was put onto your editor.
Well, that's right. I mean, it may also have been to do with the story that we broadcast a quite amazing interview with this guy Balagoon, which we recorded in this very studio on BCFM about the mayor's father and his involvement in organised crime and the allegations that he was a police informer through the time of the St Paul's riots, which you can still find out there. And that's the sort of thing, I think, which, you know, locally, is going to get your local mafia onto you, and they will say, right, well, we've marked his car, we'll get any excuse, we'll get rid of him. So whether it was to do with the fact that Martin and I have been discussing some of the research of Dr. Andrew Wakefield when he still was a doctor, and looking at some of the potential dangers of vaccines in the run-up to even before the pandemic happened. So that, you know, it's difficult to know why, of course. These questions don't get answered, but then they don't, in a way, need to be answered. The fact that Pat Hart, the editor of Bristol Community Radio, wouldn't say anything says it all.
Absolutely, it does.
So on to this chap Oliver Dowden now, because I find it fascinating, absolutely riveting in a way, the way this all works, Martin. We've now got Rishi Sunak as Prime Minister. Actually, he wasn't elected. People elected Boris. And now we've got a new regime, not necessarily quite so pro-Brexit as the previous lot were. Oliver Dowden has now been put in as a Deputy Prime Minister. I think he was Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster. Anyway, it's a massive promotion for him. And you have to ask, why has Sunak promoted him? Well, Oliver Dowden, we find this week, led a secret unit to stamp out lockdown dissent during the pandemic. So it looks as if this is one of the reasons why Dowden is now flavour of the month, is because he was doing what the establishment wanted during the lockdowns, and keeping an eye, very close eye, on various journalists, maybe us, certainly more likely to be more mainstream journalists who weren't agreeing, for example, at The Telegraph, which is a whole other story. We've been told that's up for sale this week. And so, anyway, this was discussed by Mike Graham and Isabel Oakeshott this week on Talk Radio.
Let's have a little chat about this secret government unit that we were all apparently being monitored by. I suspect you were on the list, as I was, as Molly Kingsley was. Oliver Dowden's misinformation unit has now been disbanded, we're pleased to hear. But I wonder what they were doing and exactly what they sort of learned or gleaned, or where the information is stored.
Well, I mean, what we do know is that the government very definitely took a decision to actually employ a unit in Number 10 that normally deals with counter-terror operations, to deal with people like you and me and Molly Kingsley and Julia Hartley Brewer and other people who simply wanted to have a debate about the policy response to COVID. Many of the points that we were making then, which were decried as disinformation, are now being accepted as having been absolutely right. So it gives me a little bit of pleasure, to be right honest, but I'd much rather that the whole nation hadn't had to pay the price of it. And I think that the suppression of legitimate, sensible, very necessary debate about what was going on in terms of the seizing of emergency powers and the whole excessive response to the COVID threat was one of the most sinister aspects of the COVID response. And we need to do whatever we can to make sure that debate with the compliance of the social media companies is never again shut down in that way. Mm. Social media companies have got a lot to answer for, and they're, as you know, they're still doing it. There are certain topics that you're just not allowed to present any alternative view on, and that includes climate change, by the way. If you say, actually, well, the weather's changing and I'm not totally sure, it's all man-made and so on, you are quite quickly removed from a number.
And you're sort of decried as a climate denier. I mean, we're having a lot of these conversations at the moment because of the current smoke filled North America problem, where Canada's got a lot of wildfires going on, which will probably turn out to have been set by some mad arsonists, right, rather than being set because of climate change. But apparently the smoke is travelling all the way down into sort of New York and into parts of the northern areas of America. And of course, if you question that it might not have anything to do with climate change, then you're immediately a crank.
Well, I mean, we nearly went down this route on the talk last night. Kevin O'Sullivan, our colleague, was taking on some of the rest of the panel, and I decided I just could not face it. he's absolutely right. And, you know, the suppression of debate puts us in a very weak position when we do all our kind of moral superiority over other regimes in the world where they don't have a free press. Well, I would really question the extent to which we do have free debate in this country. We actually just don't.
No, we really don't.
To pontificate from our high horse.
No, exactly right. Isabel, great to see you. Thank you very much indeed. Isabel Oakeshott, Talk TV's international editor there.
So, yes, suppression of debate. So that's, it seems to me, about what's going on. I mean, I'll just add a little rider to all of this. It was fascinating chatting to Dr. Chris Busby from the Low Level Radiation Campaign, who is one of the people who's pioneered the work uncovering leukemia clusters around nuclear power stations, saying, well, I can't get my papers published in anywhere in the West, and certainly not in English, but they're published in China. So we're told that China is some sort of oppressive place. And it may be, if you've got some private eye style expose of President Xi, you might find it difficult to get it published. But they are absolutely up for, it seems, having these big scientific debates that that are being closed down here.
Yeah, very interesting. I think that, that the fact checkers... I think that the interesting thing about the rise of the independent fact checkers, Tony, was when citizen journalism happened, when people started to post news on Facebook and Twitter, and were actually making comments on things, in their own time and things that they were looking at. I think that did pose, a problem, and the independent fact check platform started appearing shortly after that. I think Facebook and Twitter started around 2004, 2006. The independent fact-check platforms that aren't associated with the media started about 2007, the first of them, and gradually started to proliferate. But certainly in the last 10 years, the numbers have just really increased.
Okay, what subject matter do you think? What are the fact-checkers checking?
Well, you know, there's always the hot button issues, of course, and on those they tend to be always the same. You know, like COVID, climate change, gender—they're all identical. But then, when I look at these fact check platforms in different countries, because some of them are making comments, political comments, which I can't really understand whether they're taking a particular perspective, because I'm not part of that country. I don't know those politicians. But what I do notice is how many fact checks are really trivial. I would say that when you look at the list of fact checks on most fact check websites, they're very minor things, you know, like, for example, did someone have a bruise or not? Some politician, did a footballer lose his sponsorship? They're very minor things. And so what I have to say is it significant? I mean, I can't see any debate that justifies why ordinary people can't have to be protected against such minor errors.
I mean, ordinary people need to be protected against the big lies like weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Mm. It doesn't seem like any of that fact checkers. Now, the other thing about all of this is, and it should be obvious, is that this is a service which is, you may have human beings doing it. Do we know if it's being done by AI? Because that seems to be the ultimate object, is that we can just switch off all these humans. Oh, actually, no, sack them and just let a computer do all the fact checking for us.
I think that most fact check groups call themselves a sort of like an AI, have an AI human interface, so that they use a lot of AI tools, for example, to go through masses
of they'll be doing is looking for dangerous ideas.
Yeah. Yes, the fact that they fact check by looking for words, and there's programs that convert words into text, and then that text is searched for words, and then they have certain keywords, like, for example, at the beginning of the so-called pandemic, a keyword there was ventilators. So they look for keywords, and then when those keywords come up, then they're given to individual human fact checkers to check through and to make a decision on what to do about it, whether to just put a banner on that post. We're talking of social media now, whether to put a banner on the post or whether to sanction the person that's done the post, like lowering them down the feeds. And I think that Martin earlier was talking about intelligence presence very heavy in social media, and it's not just Google, because one of the things that happened when Elon Musk joined Twitter was that he sacked a lot of people, and they had a lot of links with the CIA, and Facebook as well, Meta, have a lot of CIA on their.
But, I mean, surely the whole point of that was just getting rid of human beings and letting AI do more, isn't that what?
I think that in the end, they can't completely get rid of human beings, because they, at the moment, of course, there may be a time in the future, but they couldn't do the volume of checking if it wasn't for machines. And all the time, people are designing new fact-checking tools. There's fact-checking tools for, you know, I mean, I'm just staggered sometimes, because I think, goodness me. For example, they might fact check words, they might check whether that story's appeared before, whether that photograph's appeared before, whether that video clip has been used before, or something very similar. They fact check the authors to see whether the authors have produced anything before. All of this is done by machines. They can fact check to see if photographs have been altered in any way. There's Wayback Machines, so that they can look at past at things that have been said and done in the past, to sort of like compare them. So there's just so many different fact-checking tools that are out there, and some companies list the fact-checking tools that they use, and it's not unusual for a company to have sort of like, you know, 10 or 20 different fact-check tools listed on their website as tools that they use, and a lot of them are open source. They don't cost anything. They might give money to a fact-check group to actually design tools, like, for example, Africa Check in Africa, which is one of the oldest fact-check groups, was given, I think, $2 million to develop fact-check tools. Of course, the advantage in giving that to African groups as opposed to European groups is that the wages are lower, so therefore they get more tools for their buck. So you can sort of like, you can look and see that where money's being given for fact-check groups to develop tools. But it's not only fact-check groups, because there's a whole industry which involves universities, private companies that develop AI tools. A big one in England is Logically, which actually is an offshoot of an Indian fact check group. It's also got a branch in USA, and Logically is a unusually is a for-profit fact-check group, but what it does, it develops tools and it also takes contracts from governments to actually fact-check on their behalf. It's the Big Brother Watch report showed that Logically was actually paid by the UK government, and Logically on its website says that it's paid by many governments. So it's for-profit, but it's actually taking contracts from governments to fact check on their behalf.
Well, you know what, Martin, this is the sort of thing that many people accuse China of, but actually it's happening here.
Yeah, I mean, the modern world is becoming increasingly convergent, isn't it, because of the technology. And I think it was interesting what Alex Craner said last week. The problem with AI is that it can't lie. And therefore, you've got to have a human interface at the end of it. Mm. If you are trying to spin a line about Russia,
the computer
may come up and say, well, the Russians are winning. That's no use to you, is it? So you've got to actually switch that off and then overwrite, no, the Russians are losing.
Yeah.
Shut up, computer.
And the thing is, this is where the humans need to program the tools to pick out certain types of information.
Yeah, they'll be looking for it to spin in a certain way, won't they? In other words, it's designed by a human to spin in a certain kind of way, so it's not independent at all.
It isn't.
It's just a tool.
Yeah, and when you look at, I think quite a good indicator is the Facebook third-party fact-checking program. Now, there's about, 200 and something contracts that Facebook have got with individual fact-check platforms, asking them to fact-check. But what you notice is that they don't fact-check in countries like Belarus, Russia, for example, Syria, Venezuela. But what you can see around them is that there's a lot of Facebook contracts with, for example, in Russia, you've got people like Lithuania, Georgia, that have got actually fact-check groups that actually state that they fact-check in Russian. So I think that's a demonstration that fact-check platforms are actually fact-checking Russian. And I think that I did read on, I've forgotten the name of the organisation now, but I did read about a concerted effort with funding by the UK government on fact-checking in Russia. And of course the BBC is part of that through its Media Action so-called charity, where it goes to teach journalists how to fact-check in countries like Russia and Iran in a Western favourable way.
I noticed on the World Socialist website this week, UK's National Union of Journalists has withdrawn its defence of Kit Clarenberg. So it's almost like the fact-checkers have got in at the National Union of Journalists too. Although the fact-checkers, of course, are really the propagandists, the National Union of Journalists has withdrawn its initial defence of the Grey Zone news site journalist, Kit Clarenberg. In fact, if you search for NUJ Kit Clarenberg, you'll find an article which is still in the caches of the search engines, saying NUJ expresses concern over detention of journalist Kit Clarenberg. The National Union of Journalists has expressed grave concern over the arrest of journalist Kit Clarenberg at Luton Airport under counter-terrorism legislation. Clarenberg was detained by plainclothes police officers and threatened with arrest if he failed to comply with requests for information. Now, you would have thought that is a basic thing that the journalist union should be looking out for amongst one of their members and publicising when it happens, but apparently not, Martin.
Well, obviously you would know more about the internal politics of the NUJ than I would. But it is significant that they don't feel able to stand up for a basic principle of journalism, that you shouldn't be harassed by the police for writing stuff.
When I was at the conference, there was no mention of Julian Assange, apart from in an amendment which got struck down, which I put in there, from the Wiltshire branch, about whether or not he should get a life membership of the National Union of Journalists. So I put an amendment in. They said, oh, you can't do that, you know. And so, okay, my amendment wasn't allowed to be debated, but it was the only mention in the whole agenda of Assange at the NUJ, which
although
is extraordinary.
I did hear John McDonnell mention it in his intervention.
That's right. He mentioned it when he gave his report, at the NUJ conference.
I think that it's not only unions that have been captured, Tony. For example, in Georgia, the fact-checking groups there, nearly all fact-checking groups, as I've said, are funded by Western people. And in Georgia, there's two big fact-check groups, Fact Check Georgia and Myth Detectors. And if you look at their funding, it's very heavily from police, people like the National Endowment, the NEC from America. It's very they're very politically funded, but as well as being funded by people like Facebook. But they passed a law in March this year to say that any news organization or association associated with news gathering, if it's got more than 20% of its funding coming from foreign countries, it has to register with the government. And I think it took 2 or 3 days for the government to be overturned. A similar thing happened in India at the end of last year, where they started threatening fact check groups with legal action and then stopped. Whether you approve of the Georgian law to restrict fact-checkers or not is neither here nor there, really. What's important is that in power between fact-checkers and between a government wanting to control things within its national borders, the fact-check groups had more power. So it's not surprising that the unions have bowed, because there's so much pressure there.
Well, there seems to be some sort of intimidation of one sort, unless they, NUJ, think that there was some evidence that Kit Clarenberg was a spy. I suppose that's possible. So that's been reported in various places, such as, well, it's just disappeared off of the NUJ website. It's been also reported by the Canary. It seems we've got these various taboos, and when a taboo gets broken, either an AI bot notices it or a human being notices it, and they're told this person has got to be shut down, this publication has got to be shut down, or this specific individual journalist has got to be cancelled. So we're looking at, for example, Ukraine must win, and if you say it's not, then you're not allowed to say that. COVID jabs are harmless, safe, and there's no questions allowed about that. Also, we must stop using fossil fuels, otherwise human beings will become extinct. So these various, it always seems like there's various dogmas, which are the big ones. Are there any more, apart from the ones
that
I've mentioned?
Men can be women and women can be men. I mean, women can have penises. All of these things now, politicians are coming out with. And if there's a lot of teachers, for example, who don't like the gender-affirming policies in school or the early sexual education of young children. And if they object, then their job is at risk. I mean, there's been a lot of them that have been sacked or suspended from the work.
Yeah, this cancellation thing. It reminds me a little bit of what we were told when we were kids as Soviet communism. Mm. You know, the idea that if someone spoke out against Stalin, you know, that was it or whatever.
Yeah.
But anyway, there's been more this week as well. We just heard a little bit from Isabel Oakeshott. But what about Lord Matt Ridley? He was also talking this week about the disinformation unit, which was Oliver Dowden's little baby during COVID. But anyway, this is what Lord Matt Ridley had to say about it earlier this week on Talk Radio.
I think we knew that some of this was going on, but the degree to which elected politicians who are supposed to be representing the ordinary people instead represented the interests of the civil servants, of the establishment officials, and said, what we want is to shut down debate, impose policies that we think are right, and attack people or suppress people who we don't think are right. Now, we knew during the pandemic that there were mistaken things being said from that podium in number 10, because we could tell within weeks that they were wrong. Now, that didn't mean that they were evil. It just meant that we ought to be able to challenge them. And at the end of 2021, when the scientists tried to push the UK government into a further lockdown over Christmas, if you remember, they came out with very strong predictions that there would be 6,000 deaths a day in January if they didn't. Boris Johnson held his nerve against that. There wasn't a lockdown, and there were nothing like. There wasn't even 1/20th as many deaths. So we had good examples of where You did need challenge, you did need debate, you did need to hear both sides of the argument, and there was a strong attempt to prevent that happening.
It really was. And of course, we all remember that at the time, their excuse for doing that was that, well, we should all be relieved that that didn't happen. Well, no, because if you'd locked down and people had lost even more than we now know that we did lose, that would have been a dreadful sort of miscalculation, and it would have been a terrible mistake, because we now know also from the lockdown report that came out earlier on in the week from the IEA that the 400,000 prediction of deaths was actually so far out that it turned out only to be less than 2,000.
Well, I think that lockdown report is very good. I think it's done by seriously good academics in Denmark, Sweden, and the US. Yeah. I noticed the Science Media Center trying to rubbish it, lining up a few establishment scientists to say, oh, this is just from the IEA. They would say that anyway. Right. I'm sorry, that's not the way it works in a free society. You debate reports on their merits,
yeah.
Not on who.
Also, I read a piece which was written by some guy in Forbes magazine online who was trying to rubbish it on the basis that, oh yeah, all the right wingers are claiming that this is being produced by Johns Hopkins University. It hasn't. It's been produced by one professor. So what? He's a professor at Johns Hopkins University. Why would you trash that?
Steve Hanke's a very distinguished economist, and he's got an extremely distinguished academic record.
Yeah.
Just because he holds this view doesn't mean you should outlaw him. And this is what's happening the whole time these days on lots of different issues. Certain people say, this is right, that is wrong, anyone who says otherwise should be suppressed or is in somehow an illegitimate person who shouldn't be listened to. I mean, I've been called a climate denier for 20 years now.
Right.
I've covered climate change for nearly 40 years since I was science editor of The Economist in the 80s. I'm not a denier. I'm a lukewarmer. I say that climate change is real. It's happening, and we probably need to do something about it. But we mustn't overreact, and it's not happening as badly as some people say. Mm. And the extremist solutions are going to do more harm than good. Now, that seems to me a middle-of-the-road position, but I'm constantly portrayed as an extremist and suppressed.
So that's Lord Matt Ridley, and I didn't know that he was science editor of The Economist back in the 1980s. It's also interesting, isn't it, of course, that the former editor of The New Scientist has also appeared in the documentary about climate change, The Great Global Warming Swindle. Some of these people that were working as scientists back in those days seem to have a different form of science than today, Judith.
Absolutely. I think that the science that we've seen is all from a particular perspective, isn't it, Tony? You've got I was a member of Heart, and I'm a member of Panda, and I listened to their lock lectures. I mean, for example, one of the things that it relating to climate change is this issue of meat and its role in climate change. But there's far more damage from the US military than there is from all of the cows all over the world. And so maybe one answer is to stop the US military from doing what it does rather than cows doing what they do.
I'm not sure actually cows cause any real damage whatsoever.
No. Well, we've had them for an awfully long time, Tony. But I think that what does do damage, I think that cows that are factory farmed, kept in barns, they do have a different diet. And I think that that does make them produce more methane gas than cows that are sort of like grass fed in fields.
Since Bill Gates is taking over all this farmland, I wonder whether he's going to be producing these industrial agriculture, torture chambers for animals, or whether it's all going to be, fluffy organic, happy fields with smiling cows everywhere.
I don't think so. I think that maybe they're going to farm animals, and I think that there was an article with Dr. McCullough the other day, which this is this American website, and he was I might not have this quite correct, but I think he said that if you factory farm insects and then process them into sort of like pseudo meat, that it actually takes six times as much, it causes six times as much carbon than than cows do that are fed naturally. But I think there are, I mean, I do agree a little bit that there are things that we should be doing. I think that since the last 50 years, we haven't really been very good stewards of the land. I don't like the way that we're industrialising agriculture, and I think that there would be some room to move back to more natural farming methods, and I think some people think that that would actually increase the yield rather than decrease it. And if you don't have animals, then how are you going to fertilize fields? Because you're going to be using artificial fertilizers all the time. All of these things aren't brought into the debate, are they? You know, you can have it on Dr. McCullough's website, or you know, any, some of the other alternative websites that you've mentioned, but you can't have it on the mainstream news. You certainly couldn't have it on the BBC.
No, well, I think it was John Seymour who did a book about self-sufficiency as well, but he also did a book about farming generally, written I think in the 1960s, where he explained that there were still one or two farms around back in the 1960s where they were using horses, which was largely what was used before World War II, before the American tractors turned up. And this one particular farm, he names in the book, I can't remember exactly where it was, Bedfordshire I think maybe, or Norfolk, he said it was about a 400 acre farm, and they had it had no inputs whatsoever at all. And, and what happened was the manure from the livestock fertilised the fields, and all that came from that farm was food, nothing else. So no, hardly any pollution, I imagine, whatever. And this is all being done with no pesticides, with no fertilizers, but it wasn't even called an organic farm.
No,
because in those days
that
was just farming. You know, so anyway, it's a very, very strange world what we've been sort of edged into with farming. I also had a chat with the Farming Weekly editor about some of this stuff, and he was very, very sensitive about it. This is a few months ago, probably about 6 months ago, about this whole sort of rewilding and farmers being ejected from their land because they didn't want to turn it all over to growing trees and this sort of thing. That they were actually livestock farmers and they didn't want to do that, so being bullied out, particularly by the National Trust. And he was just unprepared to talk about it at all, because he realizes if he does, then he, you know, his job, he could be out of a job. So that's the free press in farming. Martin, I mean, you know, this is amazing, isn't it, really? We always get this about China, it's all so controlled. Actually, our press is becoming, and our media really generally is becoming very, very, very strict.
It is, and I think also the way in which the media operates in the West is more insidious, because people actually think that they're well informed when they're not.
I suppose it's like in the Soviet Union, everyone knew to read between the lines.
That's right. People knew how to read between the lines. During the 1968 uprisings in various East European countries, the Polish Komsomol, the young communists, wrote an article in their magazine about how terrible what was going on in Czechoslovakia was, and that people in Poland shouldn't copy the terrible reforms in Czechoslovakia and the 10 demands of the reformers. And they put the 10 demands in the article. And of course they got it through the censors in Poland, because the whole thing was an attack job on Dubček and the Czechs. But all Dubček's demands, all 10 of them, were in there, and journalists knew how to slip that through.
Okay, so you do the hatchet job in a different country, and actually that's exactly the information the people in country B needed.
Yes, so in other words, the Komsomol in Poland were actually informing their readership of what the demands of the Czech communists
These
were.
These terrible demands, which nobody should take seriously, nobody should read, etc.
Right.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that Lord Matt Ridley was talking about there, Martin, though, was this sort of, he was saying the tug of war between in Parliament between the civil servants and the people. Well, I think maybe it's actually more between the pharmaceutical lobby, isn't it, and the people, rather than just the civil servants. The civil servants are kind of easy people to blame for the right wing, but actually they're caught in the middle of all this.
I think that's right. I think especially when you're dealing with very complex issues, which that clearly is, you're going to have a spectrum of views about it, and it's going to be very difficult to disentangle what is legitimate and what isn't. Because it's complex. I mean, some issues are very simple. You either are in favour or not in favour of going to war in Iraq. It's nice and simple. So, but things like, should we have a lockdown? Should we, you know, all of these things are bound to cause a lot more soul-searching, and there's going to be different factions within the civil service, never mind, you know, this, you know, the more you look granularly at things, the more complex all of these things are.
Let me make it clear, my own view, and it'd be interesting to hear from you two as well, is that the lockdown was an overreaction, that maybe for a week, a couple of weeks, but certainly the length of it going on for a couple of years until the Ukraine war miraculously freed us from this was an accelerationist solution. This was a dark enlightenment solution. This was the idea really is to come up with a problem and actually have a solution which makes things worse. So what about you? You don't think that though, Martin? Do you think the lockdowns were necessary?
I do, I'm afraid. So I'll be in a minority around this table, I imagine. I think that the inquiry that's going on at the moment is looking at the decisions to take lockdowns, and a fairly obvious...
Well, they're going straight for Boris, aren't they?
Boris is dead. He's a dead dog. Nobody cares about Boris. Boris cares about Boris, but nobody else does. It's quite likely he is going to be referred to the Select Committee.
But surely
there will have to be a by-election, which he will lose.
The real culprits in all of this are Big Pharma and the people that you know, were pushing on government straight away to, and even maybe the IMF, who were offering all these bribes effectively to go through the World Health Organization's hoops.
All right, well, I mean, lockdowns weren't just in Britain. There's a bit of an obsession on the right wing of politics here that we were the only people who had lockdowns. That's certainly not the case.
Well, of course it's
absolutely not.
No.
In Britain, just a basic point, I don't really want to clog up this dispute because obviously there's different views about
it. I will make sure that we do put up a report Steve Henke's report that was mentioned there. You know, I think it's important to see these things, the IEA report, saying that actually, no, the lockdowns were implemented apparently because they were being warned about 400,000 deaths. Mm-hmm. The actual number was 2,000.
All right, the Institute of Economic Affairs is a very right-wing economics think tank. So we've got to put that on. They're funded by the corporations.
So they were annoyed.
No, it doesn't matter. It doesn't mean that they're wrong.
They couldn't make their money because
they're one of those think tanks. They're one of those think tanks that won't tell you who funds them. Okay? So that's what they're one of those ones. And of course, he's actually an economist. So he's got no training in medical matters whatsoever. My training is in economics. And I would suggest to you that three lockdowns were carried out in Britain because they locked down too late, released too early, locked down too late, released too early. And when he meant about January, we all went into school on January the 1st so that everybody could infect everybody else, and then they had the lockdown. That's total incompetence by any definition. And that is what's going to come out of this report.
The
government are going to be in the dock.
Yeah, the interesting thing, Martin, is that every time a lockdown was called, it was when you just passed the peak of the numbers. So they waited until the peak of the cases started to fall. And then they called the lockdown, which meant that 2 weeks later, the number of hospital cases would decrease. So I think that you have to look at all of those facts. I mean, I am medically qualified, and in Africa, certainly, and in the Middle East to an extent, the bread and butter of my work was infection control of refugee units. But and never was anything suggested like quarantining the healthy, and if you look at all of the academic reports that are coming out now, the Brownstone Institute has got lots of them, including ones by John Hopkins University, which is very much Gates funded, are actually showing that when they look at meta studies of the effects of lockdown, that didn't work. But yes, you have a different opinion, and I think that it's amazing that we're debating it, and I like that. But talking about the effects of the COVID lockdowns ending at the time of the Ukraine war, that wasn't the only thing. I think that I spoke to you, Tony, the other day to say that Saudi Arabia, as you know, had been bombing Yemen for many years.
Oh, yes, I mean, both you and I have done quite a lot of coverage and journalistic work on this over the years. With, I mean, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of deaths now in Yemen.
Yeah, we are. But although I think they call it 8,000, but of course they're not counting. They're not counting properly. Okay, but but I think that the other interesting thing that happened, because of course the bombs for Saudi Arabia to drop were coming mainly from UK and US and from France as well, and a few from other countries. But on the 22nd of April, following the start of the Ukraine war, Saudi Arabia, without negotiation, called a ceasefire and stopped to drop bombs, which I think meant that it wasn't getting bombs from the West. And I think that's quite significant. There haven't been any peace accords until recently, which were going quite well until US decided to send an envoy to help them along, which seems to have hindered things. But but I think
that's funny you say that. Yeah. I don't want to interrupt your flow, but it's in Sudan, the Sudanese government have just kicked out the UN. They're saying that the UN is actually supporting these CIA-backed, AFRICOM-backed rebels who are basically just trying to destabilize the country for the Americans.
Yeah.
Well, so the UN is just an adjunct of the
UN. It is. And US Secretary of State is there this week talking to, of course, the government in Saudi Arabia. I think there's 9 factions that are negotiating in Yemen, and Saudi Arabia made some amazing concessions. But as I say, it's stalled at the moment. I hope that it will continue. But I think that what this demonstrates is that the US cannot conduct a war on two fronts. It doesn't have enough ammunition to conduct a war on two fronts.
This is fascinating, Martin, isn't it? It looks like as soon as that NATO supply of munitions starts to dry up, now they're thinking, oh gosh, we might need this in Ukraine, that then suddenly peace breaks out in Yemen almost.
Well, it's also because the Chinese have been working behind the scenes to rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Yeah. And Mohammed bin Salman have also shook hands with Assad in Riyadh.
So it could be that the NATO's weapons manufacturers have driven bin Salman into the Chinese arms.
I think what's bin Salman is obviously to blame in some ways for what's happened in Yemen. He didn't have to invade Yemen, he chose to do it. But I think he's wising up. He needs to have an insurance policy.
This is Judith's topic. Wasn't he egged on?
Oh yeah, he was.
Yeah, he didn't just come off his own bat. Yeah. No.
In Yemen, they say this is a proxy war. Saudi Arabia is fighting on behalf of UK and US. So definitely UK. I think the UK. Are more involved in Saudi Arabia than anyone else, and there are 40,000 UK individuals supporting the Saudi war. But I think that although there were initiatives from China initially, but I think there's a lot of peace initiatives in the Arab countries now that are starting spontaneously, and I think that this is probably partly because people know that they no longer need to fear United States. They know that United States power is weakening, so therefore they're able to sort of like negotiate and bring Assad back into the Arab League, for example. And there's also other peace negotiations. Some people have written that they think that one of the issues is that Yemen, probably with Iranian help, but certainly a lot of it was done on its own. They were making these very high precision weapons, which of course were sustainable because they're smaller, but they were also very accurate. And I think that they very accurately sent one to a site in United Arab Emirates. And so it demonstrates that they can send these missiles long distances and very accurately, although they're much smaller, and they're also sustainable because they're completely made in Yemen. So I think that some people think that also has had an impact on the West's position as well.
Well, basically the Saudis were losing, weren't they? They thought they were going to get a quick victory, just like they thought they were going to get a quick victory in the Ukraine.
Yeah.
And they've realised actually this is actually a monster of a job, and we can't do it.
Yeah, no.
Well, we'll be talking a bit later about the Ukraine, going into that in a bit of depth after the break. But before that, you mentioned that we were chatting, and that we were chatting at the weekend, weren't we, over in Bath at this thing called the Better Way Conference. We had Natalie Minnis, who was attending it, and Alex Craner, who was speaking there last week. Do you want to say something about the conference and why you decided you wanted to go?
Well, this is the second conference that I went to. I went to the previous one, and I just think that it has very up-to-date information, good speakers, and you get a chance to see speakers in real life. You can meet them at outside the conference hall and sort of like talk to them about their views, so you can get a lot of information. You can network and make a lot of contacts. For example, I made contacts with three other local groups when I was there that hopefully we're going to set up information. But I think the atmosphere last year I thought was good, but the atmosphere this year was really electric running through the conference. There was, I think, the things that people were telling us about the for example, the 5G and the increased surveillance, the food situation. I know that Norman Fenton was giving UN statistics on the food production and saying that I think it was by 2030, but I might be wrong there. It was saying that the food production is going to be down 60%. And what Norman Fenton said, the only way that they can cut food production down to 60% of its current level is if there's a program of euthanasia. So I thought that was quite significant. So we got a lot of sort of facts about the pharmaceutical companies.
But you do also get your sort of, it's almost a spectrum between brilliant academics who've been sidelined and cranks, isn't it? Or anything like this, you're bound to get a bit of that.
One's view of a crank might be quite, my view might be quite different to somebody else's. I mean, some people might think that an alternative medicine, and certainly the Better Way Conference does do that. Some people might think that a particular alternative medicine isn't useful, but I think that the majority of the speakers were quite were very erudite and informative.
Apart from Norman Fenton, what were the highlights for you then?
Well, I think it was really great to hear Andrew Brigden, and I think that he was the highlight of the conference. He had a standing ovation that went on for much longer than anybody else's, and so I think that I was really pleased to see him in the flesh. I thought that
saying what was his sort of main message?
Well, his main message was of how he'd been censored by the government, and he was just giving sort of like examples of his censorship related to his point of view on the COVID vaccines, on the WHO treaty, for example. So he was giving examples of censorship, which of course ties in very much with what we're talking about tonight. I thought that the one on the effects of 5G, that was sort of like a whole series of speakers, 10 speakers. I thought that really showed the extent of the development of surveillance and also the danger of 5G, which is a military grade weapon, and the fact that, it hasn't been debated like many other things.
Is it a military weapon? I mean, I know that the military actually did initially develop these mobile data networks for the battlefield so that they could send things like maps to their troops remotely, and that's where it all came from originally. But I mean, the idea that it is actually in itself a weapon is a whole nother ballgame.
Yeah, I think that there was evidence given that the 5G does have an effect on sort of like stupefying people and making people sort of much less likely to speak out, and as well as sort of like the increased surveillance that it can offer.
That's right. I mean, there is actually a whole group of people out there campaigning on this. In fact, next week, I think it is, I've got I did some interviews down there last weekend, and so we'll probably be hearing from them. The thing that does bother me, though, is this, there is this sort of almost like a smell hanging over, I mean, that's what I describe it as, of the whole movement, which is this group of people that say there's no such thing as a virus. In fact, they, many of them also say there's no such thing as bacteria and germs, that the whole thing's fake. And actually, a lot of our ailments, or most of our ailments, are just kind of psychosomatic.
Yeah, some people believe that. And I think the people who believe that tend to get much more aggressive than the people who don't believe it. But and in particularly in viruses, I suppose there's some sort of and particularly respiratory viruses. There's some persuasive arguments, but.
There's some very persuasive arguments that you can catch these things off people.
Yeah, exactly. This is my view that you have something like smallpox, and then other people locally don't just catch mumps; they actually catch smallpox. So it tends to make me think that something is passing from person to person. And certainly, in terms of bacteria, I don't think you can deny that, because they can be grown, they can be seen with a microscope.
Well, you know what? You can see viruses if you use electron microscope. I think it's actually called. X-ray crystallography.
Yeah.
You see them too.
Yeah.
I mean, these are discoveries.
I think Stanley, our mutual friend, has seen viruses.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And Claire Craig, that I know from.
He sent me some photographs, which I then put on our site, you know. So.
Yeah, Claire Craig said,
relating to
the coronavirus, she said the reason why you can't take a photograph of a whole coronavirus is because it's a huge virus. So it grows in the ribosome, but then when it comes out in like segments, like an orange that's got a bit of skin and some seeds in it.
This is a bit of a rabbit hole. Yeah. Sorry to send you down but there are some much more practical things, which I think fascinating to have at this conference, including we're hearing from Danielle Nuoro from Italy about here is a food supplement which will help your immune system actually get rid of the vaccine. Never mind the virus. Apparently the spike protein from the vaccine can linger around for many years in your body. Mm-hmm. But with the right
augmented NCAA, I think that one.
Yeah,
yeah.
But before that, let's have a listen to what I thought was a fantastic group that were there. They're called the Vaccine Control Group, and they are the people who are saying, well, actually, of course, in any kind of test, you need to make sure there are plenty of people around who haven't had it. Otherwise, you can't see what the point of having the vaccine was. So I had a chat to Dini and Badrea from the Vaccine Control Group last weekend.
My name's Dini.
My name's Badrea. And we're from the Vax Control Group, now rebranded as the Control Group Cooperative.
So what is a control group?
So a control group is a group of people who, in this particular instance, chose not to take the SARS-CoV-2 vaccine. And because the pharmaceutical companies have jabbed pretty much all of their control group, there is no control. So any of us who've chosen not to take the jab are the control group.
Okay, so is this a formal thing?
Yes, it is. We've made it formal. We've started studying the unvaccinated, those people who haven't taken the COVID vaccine. So we created a database system that anyone from anywhere in the world can enter their health outcomes into that can be studied. So initially we were just taking the unvaccinated. Now we're taking those people who've had the COVID vaccines as well, so we can study their health outcomes in comparison to each other.
Okay, so why?
Why? Because we need to understand what the health implications are of taking an experimental vaccine. It didn't go through the usual procedures that any other vaccine might go through, so we don't really know what the safety profile of it is. And so by studying both cohorts of people, the ones who've chosen to take the jab and the ones who've chosen not to, we will get a real idea of how people fare over the coming years and decades.
Well, I'm part of a journalist group that has been rather worried. We're seeing a lot of people dying prematurely, even people who, for example, were forced to have, well, you might say forced, you might also say coerced, in order to keep their jobs.
Yeah, absolutely. We're seeing this in our friends and families as well. So something needs to be done to actually look at what is happening to the people who didn't take it, so that we know, is it actually the vaccine or is it something else?
Well, it does sound a bit peculiar, doesn't it, to be coerced into taking something. What do you think is going on? I mean, it's an experimental thing. Why should we be involved in that? You know, you shouldn't have to get involved in an experiment, surely.
Well, I chose not to be involved in an experiment, so, but I do feel that quite a lot of people felt compelled to be part of the experiment for one reason or another, whether they felt coerced or whether they felt that they would lose their job and their livelihood by not taking it. So I think it's very important for us to take back our health sovereignty and to make choices that are right for us and right for our families, rather than what people are telling us is right for us and our families.
Hang on, we pay the government's wages. They should be safeguarding us. They shouldn't be putting us in a position where we have to take part in an experiment in order to keep our livelihood. So I'll ask you both this, your own views. What is going on?
It's a really good question. So there are all sorts of theories. We don't know exactly what's going on. Is it money? Is it some nefarious force? We're not here to make that decision. We're just here to look at the outcomes. But, I mean, there's something going on.
We're waiting for some time out.
I don't think there's a simple answer to that. I think it's very complex, and I think it involves many different individuals, many different organisations, and I think it's about us taking a step back and looking at all of the systems in place and seeing what's working, what's not working, and rebuilding what we feel is working.
Seems to me like a bit of a tug of war between personal rights, personal freedoms, and a very powerful government lobby. I mean, this is the pharmaceutical industry. They seem to, actually the governments seem to listen to them and to the World Health Organization more than they do to us.
Well, the pharmaceutical industry's money is all over it, basically. So if they're going to be sponsoring things like vaccinations within governments and sponsoring media organisations and sponsoring academic institutions, I would suggest that all of those areas are compromised by the fact that they are taking money. Then nobody's independent anymore, and I think we need some independence from their influence.
So you've got here this thing, it's a health card with someone's face on there. What is it? Jessica Helfy. Okay, so this looks like just another one of those cards, like a driving license or something, you keep in your wallet.
Absolutely. So with the Vax Control Group, we had a card which said Vax Control Group and must not be vaccinated on it. Now, the Vax Control Group has evolved into the Control Group Cooperative, and now it's about you taking control over your own health data and having your own health sovereignty. So you would have a health card which would have your blood type on it. It's also got a QR code on it. So say, for example, you were found collapsed. A paramedic could scan that QR code. They would have access to some emergency medical contact information, any vital medical information that you would want somebody in that position to have, and also any advanced medical directives that you've put in place. Whether they will honour that or not is another matter. However, they will have read that that is what your wishes are. And also, should you go and see a GP or an osteopath or a homeopath, you could then give them access to a limited amount of your medical data that would be relevant for that particular consultation.
So why is this necessary?
It's necessary because I think it's very important for us to take back control of our own health data. It's our health data.
Now, I keep hearing scares. Maybe they're real. I don't know. That my health data, my doctor has been handed over to these massive databases.
Well, it's quite possible that they have been. So how do we know whether they have or haven't?
So what's the purpose in your mind of this card?
The purpose of it, first of all, is to help people to get their information out in an emergency. And it's really important for people like us who, for example, haven't been vaccinated, don't want to have blood products. We can put that on this card and say, look, you know, if I have an accident, I don't want blood products. I don't want to have sedation. I don't want to do X, Y or Z. That's a really vital thing for us.
Well, we've had this horrific scandal, haven't we, with basically poisoned blood being given to people. And it's gone on for decades. And many of the people who were victims of it have died with no compensation at all.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, we've spoken to one of the people in Australia who's actually set up an organisation supporting these people. Awful things have happened in the name of health that we have no control over. We've got to start taking control back of our own health and the systems that are around it.
Put a firewall around our own data and allow only the people we want to have it. We had the famous WhatsApp messages from Matt Hancock. He was in charge of all of this during the time, and Boris took a kind of step back during the pandemic. So he was talking about unleashing a new variant in these WhatsApp messages. And it does sound as if that the psychology of how the public were going to react was more important than the actual medical health effect.
Yeah, absolutely. It sounds like one massive experiment, and that seems to be what we're in, a massive experiment that we've not chosen to be in.
So anyway, if people are interested in being part of the control group and stepping away from these and seeing what happens if you don't take a particular medical procedure, what should they do?
They need to come to our website, www.controlgroup.coop. And they can sign on, but have a read of all of our information, find out exactly what we're doing. You volunteer. Everyone is volunteering in this, volunteering their data. So, you know, just join up, join our communities, and put in your data.
Okay, so what's the benefit of it? Why should people take this, become part of a control group?
The control group isn't just about being a control group for any kind of medical choices that you might have made. It's also a growing community of support. So we have weekly sharing and caring Zooms where we get people from all over the world who've been coming regularly for, it's about almost a year and a half now, isn't it? We do twice weekly Zooms. So there's a lot of people who felt very alone during these past 3 years, and now they feel that they're part of a community. We also do many presentations on very, very different topics, and so we're trying to get lots of information out there to people if that's what they're looking for.
Great, thank you both very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So that's Dini and Badrea from the Vaccine Control Group. And whilst that was playing, you've got your own little card here, Judith.
Yes.
You've got out here. You're actually in the Vaccine Control Group.
I am indeed.
It looks like
yeah.
a kind of driving license, and it says at the bottom, must not be vaccinated.
Yeah.
This person is a registered participant in the SARS-CoV-2 Vaccine Control Group. But the interesting bit is this QR code in the corner here, which is what happens? Well, I mean, is this for what exactly is that for?
Don't know. I'm
well,
not into QR
what
code.
They told me apparently is if you get you get injured somewhere and paramedics come and to rescue you or whatever, they scan that and they get all your medical records that you want to them to have.
Yeah.
Not necessarily on some database somewhere. So
you fill in your medical records every month, and so it asks you if you've had COVID, what were the outcomes, what you took for it, if you've had any other illnesses. So you fill it in sort of like every single month, and then they compare the health of the people who are in the control group.
And you've done a paper on this as well.
Not me,
but
there has been a published paper by the comparing the health outcomes of the people who are not vaccinated with the.
What's the result of that then?
Well, I think that what it showed was that it did actually show that that a percentage of people of women were actually saying that they had heavier menstrual issues, which is the same as some people are vaccinated. But I think apart from that, I think compared with the general health, the general health of the vaccinated population, they had quite positive results. The menstruation issue, they were actually thinking that that could be the result of shedding, because there has been some stories of people working with other people that are vaccinated, for example.
So what is this shedding business? How does that work?
Well, I mean, the theory is that, and it was put in the Pfizer trial documents, that when people are vaccinated, they can, some of the spikes from the vaccine can be sort of like passed on to
other
people.
Okay, so the vaccine could be itself a virus, which is kind of passed on to people.
Yeah, passed on to other people.
Well, anyway, that's interesting. I think maybe we should put a copy of the on our show page at thisweek.org.uk of that report, so people can follow that up.
I'll try and find it.
Anyway, finally, from the Better Way conference, we're going to hear now from Danielle Nuaro about how to get the mRNA spike protein out of your body, allegedly.
We've been studying it with Toxicological Laboratory in Italy, okay? And this basically, the first period after the vaccination is circulating in your blood. And after a while, we don't know after how many days or after how many weeks, no one have any evidence about it, it's get attached to your receptors, to your organs. And it's not attached just like to your lung or your liver, but attached to all your organs, causing damaging them, okay, causing a lot of disease, pathology. Right now, there is a lot of research about vaccine inhibition is about 20 different symptoms. Brain fog, blood clots, neurology, joint pains, okay, so there's a lot of research about it, okay, it's about 20 different symptoms. It's all about the spike protein that's from the vaccine. Even though they don't want to call them vaccinated, but they are vaccinated, okay, they call them long COVID, okay, let's admit it, it's vaccinated patient. What we've done in Italy in our research for 3 years, to study the spike protein and to study some natural molecule to fight it, okay? And what we found, since this is artificial, so the natural molecule like quercetin, vitamin C, vitamin D, is helping us, our immune system, to tackle it for a while, but actually it's not helping to get rid of it, okay? So what Dr. Bean telling before in one of the sessions, that he said, I got some of vaccine-induced patient in treatment like with all natural molecule, okay, like vitamin D, magnesium, and like once they stop, it's come again. So like every 3 months, okay, it's come again same symptoms, because basically all this is helping you to tackle it, helping your immune system to get stronger, but not helping you to get rid of it.
Well, I know a taxi driver, I was in his taxi a few weeks ago, and he said to me, since I have my booster, I really feel bad, and the second jab, I feel bad, I wish I'd not injected it, but he said, you can't de-inject this stuff. But what you're saying is, maybe you can target these spike proteins.
Yeah, basically this, yeah.
You maybe help the body to remove them. Is that really possible?
That's really possible, and we done it in vitro, okay, before to produce the augmented NEC. So we done a treatment in the NEC because we seen that the NEC is one of the few molecules that can deactivate the spike protein. But it was in a percentage that's very low, between 12 to 15%. So it's still very low. And that's why we use the quantistic physics to acquire the signal of spike protein, this artificial one in vaccine, okay, and reverse this signal and put it in a natural molecule like the NEC that's already got some benefit, okay, to reduce the inflammation as well, as well known, okay. And from there, we completed our research and we start to give it to the doctors. And the results is really amazing, because right now, one of the, I can say it's the only supplement studied to get rid of the spike protein.
Okay, so that is Danielle Nuaro from the, the product is Augmented NCA. What do you think?
Well, I did speak to some people who were at the conference who said that that they felt that they'd, because their work involved them dealing with vaccinated people a lot, that they felt that they'd that there'd been some shedding and they were susceptible to that. And when they took the augmented NCA, they found that all of their symptoms had disappeared. I think it's very difficult to believe. People might have that impression, and I think that that might be what they say. Well, but without any statistical evidence, it's quite difficult. Well, but this man seems to have got statistical evidence.
I did put to him all the questions about snake oil, you know, so I'll put the longer version of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later. Yeah. But if you can, you're off now, Judith, so do you want to just remind people where they can get hold of your fact-checking report, who commissioned it, and you know how to get hold of that?
Well, at the moment, it's part of a bigger study and it hasn't been published yet. I'm in a fact-checking a media group at PANDA, the Pandemics Data Analysis, which is a South African advocacy group, which contains lots of academics of different sorts, and various people are doing various bits relating to censorship, and mine is the fact-checking. So when it's produced, it will be there. But I've got a paper that's being read by some people in PANDA who are peer reviewing it. So I'm hoping it will go onto the PANDA website in the near future. And if it does, I'll definitely let you know. In between, while on the 1st of June, I did an interview for UK Column. And so if people want to look up, they can look at that.
Well, they can listen to this.
Go listen to this.
Yeah, it's even more up to date. Yeah. Anyway, so what I'll do is what I will try and do. Is it possible for me to send out this report?
Which
the one you've done?
Oh yes, I've given one to you, and okay, yes, you brilliant. Can send that. That's
you lucky prep. Listeners, if you're this is something that you don't get on the UK column. If you're on our email list and you're not a Gmail user, because I'm still struggling with actually getting Gmail people to be able to receive our weekly email. I shall send you that over the weekend sometime. Anyway, Dr. Judith Brown, thanks ever so much for joining us again.
Thank you for inviting me, Tony.
I will put a link up to that. We put it up on the internet so people can find that easily. Yeah. And I'll do that as soon as possible over the weekend anyway, at some point.
Okay.
Now, final interview from the Better Way conference this week, I'll probably have some more next week, is a bit of a curveball, really. And this is to do with the Oxfordshire Solar campaign with Anne Gwinnett.
My name's Anne Gwinnett and I live in Oxfordshire. I've lived there since 2008, and there are a lot of things going on. So in Oxford itself, they're pushing forward with LTNs, the low traffic neighbourhoods, and the traffic filters. So it's an obvious move towards the 15-minute cities, and in fact they say that now quite openly. And the city and the county council in particular, because of course they're the ones who are pushing this agenda, are not listening to what the people want. So there have been a number of consultations, and it's been difficult, the way they've been framed, for people to clearly say what they think if they don't want them. But regardless of that, in spite of that, people have used the comment sections to say how much they don't want these things. And at the county council meeting, where they were going to make the decision on whether to go ahead with the traffic filters, there were an unprecedented number of people asked to speak. I think they had 53 people speak. And the vast majority of those were absolutely against these traffic filters.
You know what's going on is they're trying to stop people using cars, because actually maybe it's better to use bicycles, public transport, that sort of thing.
Well, that's all very well, but if that's their real objective, they should be making public transport better first, and they haven't done that. What they're doing is they're introducing all these restrictions, and the impact of those restrictions is that people can't get where they need to get to. There are many, many small businesses that have either already closed or are now in the process of closing, particularly in places like Cowley Road. And so that's having an absolutely dreadful impact on the local economy. Small businesses are going to the wall, the community is being affected, and people are actually struggling now to lead normal daily lives in Oxford. So, you know, they can't easily get an electrician or a plumber because it's difficult for them to get to the houses there due to the increased congestion. So they're saying these LTNs will reduce congestion and pollution, But actually, it's increasing congestion around the city because it's just moving the traffic, and that's making congestion worse, which means in some parts of the city, the pollution levels are going up, and their own data is showing that in certain places, they are above the legal limit. So it's not achieving what they say they're trying to achieve, but they're ploughing ahead with them regardless.
So what's this all about then, if it's not actually doing what it's supposed to do?
Well, that's a really good question, isn't it? And if you ask the councils, you don't really get a clear answer, because they just continue to say it's all about saving the planet. And if they've got everybody so hyped up, I mean, you know, across the country about the need for this zero carbon, that is used as the excuse for everything. But when you look at the outcomes of what they're doing, that doesn't actually add up.
Okay, so I ask you again, what do you think is going on here? Because obviously the problem is there. We know there's a problem with pollution, but the solution seems to be making things worse. What, is it just, I suppose we could look at, is this a conspiracy theory or just cock up? Because it's not the only policy which seems to be making things worse. We've decided in Ukraine as well, we're going to send loads of weapons to the Ukrainians who can't possibly beat Russia, and that also seems to be making things worse. So it seems to be a bit of a pattern here.
Well, yes, it does. And in fact, there's also a very large solar farm proposal in Oxfordshire. And that, if it goes ahead, would be by far the largest solar farm, not just in the UK, but in Europe. And there are so many reasons why that's a bad idea. So
where is that happening and when, do you know?
Well, they've had the informal consultation on it in November, December last year. The formal consultation was due to be in the spring, and they've actually now pushed that back to sometime in the summer, but we don't have a clear date yet. But it's the same question, really, because if you look at the proposals, and there are many, many proposals across the country for solar farms on agricultural land, and the question is, why agricultural land in the world that we live in now, where we ought to be looking to be more self-sufficient in terms of our food security, why are we pushing solar farms on fields? If we're going to have solar, and that's a big if, but if we are, then they should be on the top of buildings. We have so many business parks, science parks, university buildings, houses, and yet we're not putting them there. The government are pushing to have them, or pushing these schemes through the national infrastructure projects to put them on fields. And our argument is it's the wrong solution in the wrong place. Solar is the least efficient renewable energy, so it makes no sense, and at the expense of agricultural land.
Okay, so where is this farm and how big is it?
Well, it stretches, it's in three sections. So the smallest section is near Botley and Cumnor, and it's called Botley West. The next section is the largest, and it's to the west of Kidlington, around Yarnton and Begbrook and Bladen. And then the northern section is to the east of Woodstock and up to the northwest of Tackley. So in total, it stretches around about 11 miles north to south, but it's in these three sections, and it will cover, if it goes ahead, nearly 3,500 acres of agricultural land.
So, Better Way Medical Conference, that wasn't really a medical person there. That was Anne Gwinnett speaking about this new mega solar farm. I suppose the obvious question, Martin, here is, why is this agricultural land all being purloined for, as she says there, it should really be on existing buildings? I know the previous Labour government, before 2010, actually was facilitating ordinary householders putting solar panels on their roof.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, I didn't necessarily know about this particular development, but it obviously makes more sense to put solar panels on buildings than on potentially farmland, although, of course, it may well be that ultimately British farmland is not actually competitive in international terms. So you've got to protect the farmers.
Well, there's this attempt to stop people growing food for some reason, isn't there?
Well, it could also be that you can make more money out of the solar panels than you can out of growing food on the relevant piece of land.
And also,
that's because the prices are all rigged.
There's not many Labour voters that own that land, do they?
No, I mean, don't forget the farmers who put the solar panels in, if it is farmers, they're looking to take, soak up government subsidies for using solar and just to make a profit, aren't they?
Yeah, taking it also out of food production. Fascinating. Anyway, so that's the Botley Kidlington Woodstock massive 11-mile solar farm in Oxfordshire. Incredible, really. Anyway, so thanks ever so much for that. So that was Anne at Gwynedd, as I said, and there is a website for that campaign. I'll put the full version of that interview up again on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. What do you think of this general thing, the Better Way conference, though, Martin? I mean, we obviously had guests last week and a lot about it this week. It's happened in Bath, and this seems to have attracted people from all over the world. I mean, I even met there this chap called Dr. Heike Schoening, who is a German doctor, who's one of the first people saying, look, you know, we need to be very careful about the way we react to this COVID, because it looks to me as if it's an overreaction. He was an interesting character to meet, didn't want to be interviewed and didn't want to even have his photograph taken. But I suppose that's understandable. But you know, obviously, this is an international event now that's taking place in Bath every year.
Well, obviously, I've been exposed to what happened at the event because of the guests we've had this week and last week. I've got some things in common with the people there, no doubt. I mean, Alex Craner, I thought, was pretty much on the money about most of the things.
Yeah, well, he's not talking in a medical fashion. He's saying actually what's going on is there's been a bamboozlement of the entire population of the West to go down a certain route here towards vaccines, which was just not appropriate.
Well, I've got much more time for the critique of the vaccines than I have about the lockdowns, because I believe that COVID itself is a biological warfare attack on China. That's my militaristic perspective. So I don't see this as a big pharma, a part of the Western deep state, but they're not the only part.
They're certainly not. And I think the way the politicians dealt with it was appalling, as well as the all of them, really. And particularly the Labour Party, very, very concerning. The Labour Party are now moaning about the way the Tories dealt with it, but actually they would have done far more draconian measures, it seems. That's what they spelt out. They were always doing that right the way through the pandemic, is saying, well, we should be having more controlling influence. And I think that this basic disillusionment with politics generally, and politicians particularly, we seem to be getting the very most low grade. I mean, these politicians now, particularly under Rishi Sunak, we seem to get all sorts of people who just look like some sort of spiv businessman turning up, and all suddenly he's a minister of some sort. And at BBC Question Time from King's Lynn last night, there was quite a lot of this. It was actually rather a wonderful watch for quite a while, with Jonathan Rowley from the Labour Party, and a guy called Lee Ashworth, who's very much this kind of spiv kind of character, appearing out of nowhere, apparently. I've never come across him. Apparently, he was housing minister for 2 weeks, and then he was promoted to some other job. But anyway, Lord Sumption was on it as well. Interesting panel they had in King's Lynn. But the most interesting person by far was one of the members of the audience.
We just had the latest NHS waiting list out today. 7.5 million people on a waiting list. You know, it's the highest it's been. When Rishi Sunak a few months ago said we're going to bring waiting lists down, they've actually gone up by another 250,000 or so. I mean, how many of you have tried to get a GP appointment on a Monday morning when you're ringing up? You know, we've got schools around the country with their ceilings collapsing, or the pupils being moved out of the school into community centres and sports halls because the ceiling might collapse. And then, of course, we've got what's been happening in the economy because of the decisions that were taken last autumn when we had this borrowing binge, which led to turmoil on the money markets, a run on pension funds, people's pensions being put at risk, and now mortgages going up for everybody by hundreds of pounds, if not thousands of pounds. This is what has happened. This is the situation we are in after 13 long, hard years of the Conservatives. And I think, Lee, the people have had enough of the Conservatives.
All right, well, let's hear from the people. I'll let you come back in, but let's hear a bit from our audience. Right, the man there with the hat and the red handkerchief.
We've heard all before from both of you, from both parties. You're absolutely incompetent, the whole parish and lot of you. And those that are not incompetent are corrupt. I have no idea why any of us bothered to vote for any of you. You couldn't run a Welsh store, let alone the country, either of you. And all you can do is bat off each other and not make any sense whatsoever. Stay behind afterwards, both of you. Have a word with me. I'll give you some home truths.
Don't worry.
That you need to deal with.
You're off.
I'm sick to death, you lot. All of them. The only person who entered the Parliament with good intentions is Guy Fawkes.
So, Martin, what do you reckon to that? Saying basically both of the parties are just playing games with us, really, batting stuff backwards and forwards.
Well, it's part of the psyop surrounding us that people think that the politicians are all the same and therefore we shouldn't be participating in politics, which just allows the politicians to get on with doing what they want
but
to
Starmer
do.
What's the guy saying?
You're not going to vote. Well, what are you going to do?
No,
you're going to have an anarchist revolution?
He's saying Guy Fawkes, isn't he?
Yes, and he was a Catholic terrorist who was manipulated by the deep state of the time in order to try.
You don't like it because actually what he's saying is true. Actually, the Starmer faction of the Labour Party is far, far closer to the Tories than the Corbyn faction, for example, and there's no real proper opposition going on at the moment.
That's because of the first-past-the-post system, Tony, because he has to win over former Conservative voters. If we had a proportional system, like in any other country in Europe, you could have a left-wing party, a centrist party, and a right-wing party and a far-right party. I mean,
this is a complete myth. It's nothing whatsoever to do with the system. Jeremy Corbyn could easily have won that election in 2017, but he was undermined by his own party, by the Mandelsonites and the Starmerites in his own party,
yes,
who made sure he didn't
win. Because he shouldn't have been in the Labour Party.
That's not the first past the post system, is it? Labour Party.
It is.
That's a corruption. Corruption by the apparatchiks within the party.
Right. So what do you do, Tony? Do you take the party over again? You're not a member of any party. So you can't really comment about what happens in the Labour
Party.
I
can comment as much as I want. Well, yes, I can. Well, actually, what happened is Farage did a very good job in steering the Conservative Party from outside. Why can't that happen in the Labour Party?
Because but that's possibly what will happen at the next election.
Maybe it will.
What will happen around here, Tony, is that the Greens can smell victory over Thangam Debonair's Labour Party in Bristol West, and that'll put one more Green MP into Parliament, which won't change anything, because the system itself forces the parties to be the same, to win the same centrist voters in the same marginal constituencies, which there's only less than 1 million people.
He didn't force them. Jeremy Corbyn wasn't forced.
No, he wasn't forced. And what happened, Tony, is
he
under first past the post, and you've got to accept that you're going to be undermined by your own party as well. Don't forget, in the Tory party, people like Heseltine have been members for all of their lives, have been booted out by the Johnsonites. So
it's becoming a game politics, and it's maybe always been a game, but it's even more so of a game. As I've been saying for a few weeks now, it's quite obvious to me that the Conservatives don't actually want to win next time. They're trying to lose it, because they know that all these economic chickens are coming home to roost. They'd much rather somebody like Starmer, it landed on his lap rather than theirs.
Well, I'm sure there's many of them thinking exactly like that. And of course, they've had a good run. And of course, in the cricketing way that we run our elections, both teams are supposed to bat in turn and all the rest of it. Now, that is not, in fact, the way to run a modern country.
No, of course it's not.
Hopeless.
No. And I agree with you with the first past the post, of course. But despite the system, I don't agree. Also, you know, I don't think that that's exactly why we are where we are.
And there's other forces
at work. It's a
necessary but not sufficient change.
Yeah. In charge here, to a large extent, is the pharmaceutical lobby, which we've just been hearing about, the major lobbies. But who's behind them? Well, most of them, it's private equity. And good old BBC Radio 4, you don't often hear me say that, did a quite interesting half-hour documentary about what is private equity this week by Ben Chu, who's the Newsnight's economics editor. I suppose he's taken over from Paul Mason, who was doing that a decade or so ago. They called it the Hidden Masters of the Universe.
Is its arrival something ordinary workers should fear? Or is private equity unfairly maligned? I'm Ben Chu, economics editor of BBC Newsnight, and this is what I'll be investigating on The Hidden Masters of the Universe. Private equity touches every part of our lives, from the cradle to the grave.
Private equity money has flooded the medical industry in recent years.
Two of the largest nursery chains in the UK are private equity owned. Same is true of three of the UK's biggest care home groups.
Large corporations and private equity firms are buying up veterinary offices at an alarming rate.
Half of the UK's veterinary practices are owned by just six companies, and three of them are private equity firms. From high street restaurant chains to supermarkets.
The supermarket giant Morrisons has accepted a takeover deal worth £6.3 billion from a...
To chemists, to dentists.
Thames Water, wholesale wastewater.
To water companies, to football clubs.
Roman Abramovich has completed the sale of Chelsea Football Club.
To even the music we listen to.
Justin Timberlake is cashing in on his music. Timberlake sold the rights to his song catalogue to a fund backed by Blackstone.
In almost every area of our lives, private equity is likely to be involved. The more you look around, the more you find it.
Kim Kardashian needs little introduction. And now, well, she's moving into the world of finance to launch her own private equity firm.
Private equity firm Ethical Capital Partners has acquired MindGeek, the owner of Pornhub.
To its critics, private equity is locust capitalism, barbarians at the gate. Financiers asset stripping and hollowing out good companies, screwing over workers.
What ends up happening is that these costs are shifted in the form of under resourcing services and exploiting workers.
To its defenders, it saves companies, improves how they're run, creates jobs, and makes the entire economy larger.
It's grown because it's been economically successful and people have chased success, no different than anything else in life.
To others, though, it's more a form of financial smoke and mirrors, a kind of trick played on us all.
The idea that somehow that a bunch of former investment bankers are magically good at identifying new revenue opportunities for companies just doesn't pass the smell test.
But for most, let's be honest, private equity is simply a mystery. Financial masters whose workings are hidden from our daily lives.
So that's Ben Chu, the introduction to his half-hour documentary on Radio 4 this week, Martin. It's nice to see the BBC doing something worthwhile. Talking a lot about Blackstone, what is private equity?
Well, a private equity firm doesn't have listed shares. It's basically owned by wealthy individuals who are not identified quite often. And this is what causes a lot of people to wonder what they're actually up to, because they... You know, they don't have shareholder meetings or anything of that
sort.
It's
terrific. There's no transparency, basically. No, it's a terrific list he gave there. Supermarket chains, nursery chains, care home chains, veterinary chains, retirement home chains, chemists, dentists, water, football and music. I mean, all these industries are now becoming largely... controlled and owned by, in fact, I mean, a varying percentage, but many of them, you know, half of the industry is owned and controlled by these people. And the obvious thing in any of those industries is to buy up the competition to shut it down.
Well, that's exactly what's been happening in the US with Blackstone. Blackstone took over the role of the Federal Reserve in 2019 in September.
BlackRock, sorry. This is Blackstone, which is... Yeah. I mean, in a way, you bring up BlackRock is a good idea, because there is that brilliant documentary about Vanguard and BlackRock, which goes, in a way, one step beyond what Ben Chu is prepared to look
indeed,
at here.
Indeed, and BlackRock... In September 2019, there was a crisis on the repo market in the US, and without telling anybody, the government intervened, giving BlackRock the role of identifying which companies were going to be bailed out under the table and which companies were not going to be bailed out. Of course, they bailed out most of their own companies. BlackRock itself is owned by Vanguard, which is the private equity wing. Yeah,
so BlackRock itself isn't private equity. It describes itself as a multinational investment company based in New York, founded in 1988 as a risk management and fixed income institutional asset manager. It's the world's largest asset manager with, would you like to guess how many trillion dollars of assets?
I have no idea.
$9 trillion.
Yeah.
It's 9,000 billion.
Yeah, well, that's probably, you know, don't forget you all control through supply chains and other things a lot bigger than that. They've become
these
a monster.
These are the sort of people that pop up at Bilderberg. These
yes,
are the
of course.
Characters.
Now, what happened in September 2019, there was a clash in the repo market. Blackstone then were put in charge of, essentially, of government
BlackRock.
BlackRock. I keep mixing it up. And then, of course, in the November, we are informed that the Defense Intelligence Agency of the United States informed the Israeli Defense Forces there was going to be a pandemic from China, and then everything, all, that for me is the motive for what was happening, was exactly the collapse in the US stock markets, which was hidden from us at the time. So that they then unleash the pandemic as the response to that. And anyway, that's a bit of a diversion from discussing private equity.
So Blackstone and BlackRock sound as if they might actually be related, and of course they are. Blackstone is also based in New York City, but they're a private investment, private equity firm, whereas BlackRock is a public company. So there is a little bit of difference.
The shares in BlackRock are all owned by Vanguard, and nobody knows who the hell they are. So in other words, what's happening is a massive concentration of wealth and power in the hands of a very small number of people.
These people are very clever at avoiding tax as well, aren't they?
Of course.
It might be interesting, you know, if governments could, would governments dare, the HM Revenue and Customs dare to take these people on?
Well, they've got themselves into an unassailable position where they're too big to fail and the government has to bail them out. And then they turn around and say, oh, well, you know, we're now going to tell you what to do. Most of these industries, like water industries, should simply be in the public sector. Yeah, not even a stock market quoted firm. This should just be run by the government on a not-for-profit basis. Or if you're going to make a profit, that profit is for reinvestment in water supply. But of course, the financial structure on top of all of this is like it's like what was called a vampire squid on the face of humanity when they were talking about Goldman Sachs. This is all parasitic, as Hudson points out. None of this produces anything. It's a way of sucking value out of the economy and pumping it into the hands of a wealthy oligarchy who don't, in fact, have a better widget to make or sell. They just parasite on other people who've already done that work for them.
And some would argue that this is the philosophy, the financial arrangement, and the political will that the Russians are fighting in Ukraine.
That's exactly what they would say, the Russians, that is, because their own oligarchy was well out of control in the 1990s, but they reined them in. Whereas in the West, the oligarchy is still firmly in the driving seat.
Now, in that documentary, there is mention of this film, Barbarians at the Gate, a 1993 American biographical comedy, well worth watching. I would suggest if you can get hold of a copy, and directed by Glenn Jordan, written by Larry Gelbart, based on the 1989 book of the same name. Now, it tells the true story of F. Ross Johnson, who was the president and CEO of RJR Nabisco. And it was all to do with hostile takeovers, this sort of thing. How do you use, basically, bully and browbeat a board of a business into controlling it? And, of course, you know, the other thing is Ben Chu there used a news clip which mentioned Morrison's. Now, the supermarket market is quite obvious that the Tesco boss, his surname is Leahy, he was the guy that brokered the deal that took over Morrison's. So he's quite likely there just trying to make sure. In fact, I was chatting to some security guards in one of the Morrison's recently. I said, oh, they're just asset stripping the company at the moment. So this is exactly the sort of thing you would expect, as private equity move in on a massive supermarket chain. The point is, if you close this down, then the other supermarkets can put their prices up. And the government doesn't seem interested in this at all.
Well, it's all free market, you see, Tony. That's the ideology. It's all free market. And as the guy said, they're chasing profits. And what's the matter with that? Profits are good. But of course, in the past, governments realised that the economy can't just be left to these kind of vultures. And if you do, your economy is gradually undermined, as the British and US economies have been completely undermined since the Thatcher-Reagan era. In Russia, they've still got a nationalised arms industry, highly efficient compared to the West. In China, they've still got a nationalised banking system, highly efficient compared to the West. And the West is going to find having parasites in charge means that you can't run, you can't run a war on that basis. You're definitely going to lose.
I'm reminded very much of this film from years ago. I think it was about 2000, wasn't it? The film The Corporation, a Canadian film, which looked into the fact that, in a way, a corporation is like an immortal person, because in law, the corporation, in law, is a person. I mean, what you're doing is you're creating something. Somebody has responsibility and can own land and can own objects and things. But before these private limited companies and incorporation acts and things like royal charters were that the corporation took their place. And so the idea is that this thing can live forever with a whole bunch of individuals who are the board of directors. But it's just a bizarre thing, isn't it, the idea that a massive company like BlackRock is almost like a big living creature.
Well, but the corporation, when that came out, was talking about corporations as we used to know of them, like General Motors or, you know, ITT that were behind
it was very good at talking about how some of the personalities of these corporations are psychopathic. So let's have a listen to that clip now.
The typical company of the 20th century, extractive, wasteful, abusive, linear in all of its processes, taking from the earth, making, wasting, sending its products back to the biosphere, waste to a landfill. We're leaving a terrible legacy of poison and diminishment of the environment for our grandchildren's grandchildren, generations not yet born. Some people have called that intergenerational tyranny, a form of taxation without representation, levied by us, some generations yet to be.
Also in the corporation, the film, documentary, the Canadian documentary, I think it's about 2.5 hours long. It's quite a long, but it's a terrific, and it's almost like a great landmark that is, you forget about at your peril. Make sure you got your copy to listen to, or watch whenever you need to, if you get frustrated with the rubbish on TV, stick the corporation on.
When you look at a corporation, just like when you look at a slave owner, you want to distinguish between the institution and the individual. So slavery, for example, or other forms of tyranny are inherently monstrous. But the individuals participating in them may be the nicest guys you can imagine. Benevolent, friendly, nice to their children, even nice to their slaves, caring about other people. I mean, as individuals, they may be anything. In their institutional role, they're monsters because the institution's monstrous.
Interesting. That's obviously the voice of Noam Chomsky there, Martin. This is quite a landmark film in a way, and important to make this to distinguish between the way that a corporation acts and the way that it's, you know, its own individual. I can remember being gobsmacked meeting David Rockefeller. Fascinating guy, very obviously part of the Standard Oil legacy and massive shares in Exxon, all that sort of thing. Still very, very wealthy guy, involved through those shares in appointing people to the boards of loads of very powerful corporations. But he comes across as a very affable chap. He wants to talk about nothing to do with his businesses and the blight that is going on in the world. He just wants to talk about the local fish restaurant. So it's quite important, isn't it, that distinguishing what Chomsky's doing, the distinguishing between the individual and the corporation itself. It's almost as if they are washing their hands of the consequences of what they're doing sitting around that board.
That's true. And of course, what's happened with the financialization of corporations is that the people on the board don't necessarily have the interests of the corporation as such in their minds, because they make money from share buybacks and things of this sort, because managers in corporations used to be employees of the shareholders, and therefore they were somewhat, you know, their remuneration was separate from the share prices. And of course the Thatcher-Reagan revolution was to put the managers of corporations they were paid in shares basically, so therefore all they do is loot the corporation for the shareholders, and then as your friend, your security guard in Morrison's is quite aware, it's going to end up with him being cast out of his job so that they can make money out of closing Morrison's down. And that is not, in fact, a long-term rational strategy.
It's the free market, man, the free market.
It's not the free market. It's actually, in actual fact, it's monopolization by the financial sector. And countries which
it's a method of price fixing, isn't it?
It is a method of price fixing in the interests of a wealthy elite that own the shares. But ultimately, of course, if you're in peer competition with the People's Liberation Army of China and the Russian armed forces, you are going to find that that will not cut the mustard. It just won't. Andrei Martinov, who writes Reminiscences of the Future blog, he's an ex-Russian naval officer, just points out how incapable the US and the British are organising a war.
Is that why maybe that we don't have Chinese and Russian supermarkets in competition with Tesco's?
Well, in China and Russia, you will.
No, it's not here. I'm talking about here. Well, all these sanctions are to stop the Russians competing, aren't they?
What's happened in Russia and in Russia in particular is that McDonald's, for example, has just been taken over by a Russian franchise, and you eat pretty much the same burgers you used to eat, but it's the money doesn't go to McDonald's anymore. It goes to the Russians.
Yes, well, there you go. Shot themselves in the foot there, all right, didn't they? Final clip from the corporation, then.
The corporation is not a person. It doesn't think. People in it think. And for them, it is legitimate to create Terminator technology so that farmers are not able to save their seeds. Seeds that will destroy themselves through a suicide gene. Seeds that are designed to only produce crop in one season. You really need to have a brutal mind. It's a war against evolution to even think in those terms.
That's Vandana Shiva speaking in the corporation. Shame on you if you don't have a copy of it. Make sure you've got a copy in your house. I would say you can just download it as an MP4, burn it onto a DVD, anything. One of those really important, I mean, maybe we should do a recommended film list of all the basic interest. But anyway, what she's saying there, Martin, is this is moving towards termination of lives. I mean, you know, the idea that if you don't buy the seed from the corporation, you can't save the seeds anymore. That Dan Shiva's point, that this is actually completely undermining farmers, you know, right across the world with this technology.
Well, that's right. And of course, she's based in India, and you saw the farmers in India put up a huge fight to prevent the privatization of their marketing boards, which had been in India since independence.
When we had the milk marketing board, gotten rid of here, there was no protest at all, was there?
Well, the Indian farmers are obviously more militant because they've got more to lose. I mean, you know, if the Modi government had to back down and prevent the abolition of the marketing boards, which is what was being demanded by the usual suspects, you know, the World Bank, IMF, etc.
Okay, final clip before the break is universal basic income. This is apparently the great solution to all of this, and it was discussed on Channel 4 News this week.
You and Lapanen, I mean, Finland tried this already. What did it find? What were the answers to some of the questions being posed by Will Strong there?
No, thank you, Jackie. And first of all, I'm really happy to see new experiments being planned here in England as well. It's really important to explore policies that are actually fitting to the challenges of our times. The Finnish experiment, which was launched in 2017 and ran for 2 years, was launched under a conservative coalition. So the framing of that experiment was very much on employment, which was rather interesting. So 2 years, 2,000 Finns unemployed for a benefit of 560 euros a month. And the basic learnings of the experiment were quite interesting. On employment, we saw a small but statistically significant increase in employment, so roughly 6 days a year on employment per individual, which was actually larger if you considered families with children. Then, perhaps more interestingly, even though the framing of the experiment was around employment, the research group added lots of factors similar to what Will is suggesting on mental well-being and mental health, etc. So on those, what we saw on mental health was a significant increase in mental health, so less depression, less mental strain, less loneliness as something that people perceived, and also a stronger ability to believe in one's cognitive abilities in the context of where they were. Also, an increase in physical health and trust in the future and capacity to influence the future, and also peers and institutions. So, roughly speaking, those were the outcomes of the Finnish experiment.
Interesting, given all of that, the Finnish government didn't pursue the policy in the end, did they?
No, but the original policy was suggested to be two-faced and under a conservative coalition. So the coalition then decided not to proceed with the second phase. We've had experiments on labour markets, but we haven't seen a continuation in regards to a new experiment. How I see it is that political contexts differ. So we have different situations in different countries around the world. When it comes to universal basic income, the most important thing is that we see different experiments from which we learn, increase the evidence base, try to really understand what the actual universal basic income can achieve.
So that's the Channel 4 news from earlier this week. I mean, you've got to say, it's a pretty reasonable survey if you've got people actually, even though they're being paid by the government, they're still bothering to go out and get some money by working. And, you know, in that context, of course, this is a completely experiment out of the blue. It's not that there's a culture that's built up around this. Although, of course, in Britain, there is, I mean, probably the same in Finland too. People going to do cash in hand work whilst claiming the dole at the same time. That's happened. So anyway, what do you make of all of these moves in the UK now to start considering this? And maybe it's just Rishi Sunak and his Goldman Sachs background. He's thinking, yeah, let's do
well,
this.
Well, as the Finnish person there was saying, the Conservative coalition in Finland brought it in, but they weren't very keen on it working. So when they found out that as he pointed out, it actually did increase people's employment. And of course it would do if I'm paid a basic income, but I can earn any amount of money on top of that. I'm on universal credit. I have been for many, many years now. And it's not in my interest to do more than a certain amount of work because they just take it off me. If they gave me it, it would become in my interest to do any hours I could to maximise my income. But since they're going to take it off me, there's no point. And, it's a trap. Lots of people on benefits, for example, are better off on benefits because their housing costs are so great.
This trial is taking place in the UK with only 30 people. They had 2,000 over in Finland. Maybe it's a similar thing. The Conservatives are setting this up to fail.
I think that's probably true. I mean, there is a broad spectrum of support for universal basic income. It isn't just a left-wing thing. The Welsh government are going to give it to quite a lot of people who are coming out of care, for example. I think that's their plan.
I don't know if you could apply to take part, Martin. It'd be quite nice. £1,600 a month, no questions asked.
Well, I think ultimately something like this is going to happen because it makes sense, because it incentivizes people. Some people can't work or don't want to work.
There's also a massive bureaucracy. There's a massive bureaucracy around all this, and lots of people thrown off benefits for no good reason. Say, for example, if a bus is late, suddenly you've got no money at all. You can't even buy toilet paper for a month.
What I would do with a universal basic income, I would tie it to political participation.
Ooh.
So you basically,
believe in voting.
In Athens, for example, when they had the democracy, of course, slaves and women were not included in it.
Are you going to increase the quality of political parties happens?
Well, let's just talk in the abstract for a moment,
right,
Tony.
Yes.
They used to have big jury trials in Athens, and they didn't just have 12 people on the jury, they'd often have hundreds of people on the jury. Now, small farmers couldn't afford to take a day off work to be on the jury, so they were all paid to be on the jury, if they were citizens. And you could do the same thing in a country. You could say, if you're a citizen of this country, you're entitled to a citizen's income because you are a citizen. But you must perform the duties of a citizen, that is, you must turn up to the vote. You don't have to vote for anybody. You can spoil your ballot paper if you're an anarchist or whatever, but if you want this universal citizen's income, you've got to fulfil the basic rules of citizenship, which is you participate in the political system. And then, of course, you build up a support for people who vote to have universal basic income or citizen's income because it's in their interest to support it. And that's how the democracy in Athens was consolidated against the oligarchy, because you've got lots of smaller farmers and people like that who suddenly became in their interest to have a democracy so that they could have a say, and the government would then pay them to participate. And of course, what used to happen in Athens is slaves used to go round, and there's round people up and take them off to the meetings. You know, you've got to go to the meeting, but I don't want to. You got to.
Yeah. So, is it going to happen in Britain? Do you think?
I think it will happen in all over the world.
Is it going to have to get things? Going to have to get worse?
Yeah, I think
we've got structural unemployment. This is the thing: is ever since really the Thatcher era, we've had millions and millions of unemployed people, and this is actually serves the interests of big business.
It does, but what we've actually got now is, we've got people in work who are earning hardly enough to keep the roof over their heads. And that is what you need to do, is give them the security of a basic income. And then they can also go. The beauty of it is people can work as many hours as are suitable for them. You know, if you're looking after an elderly relative, you don't have to go and look for full-time work. And it would change the labour market quite dramatically and make it more flexible.
So it also means that,
they would be able to employ people on a part-time basis, and everybody would just get used to being employed in that kind of way.
In your business, for example, in schools, it may be that teachers would choose not to work for an incompetent head, for example.
Well, what it does is it means people get more power. They know if they're being bullied around, they can walk away.
I think this is the problem for the Tories and for the stock markets. This is people could walk away from jobs.
Yes, I mean, they don't want any reforms which are going to empower the working class. They've spent 30 and 40 years ramming us into the floor. And, you know, real wages are falling. What's not to like as far as they're concerned? And also, everything that's happened from 2008, the pandemic, everything, the people at the top have made a fortune out of all of that. Not only have they not suffered, it's been a huge success from their point of view. So they're not at all busy to try and change it. It's the ordinary people who will ultimately have to change it, because I'm not, you know, the government is going to look after us, because we're going to make sure it does. And that requires mobilisation.
This is the sort of thing that's much more likely to happen under Starmer, isn't it, than under the Tories?
Well, Starmer's already ruled out basic income.
Oh, has he now? Interesting.
It's the sort of thing he doesn't want to talk about, because he thinks it will frighten
Corbyn.
Horses.
Maybe it's a Jeremy Corbyn.
Well, I think that what they will try and bodge along until you've got mass unemployment, which will happen at some point, because this financial system is totally unsustainable.
Isn't this part of the Great Reset? They're saying that actually the old economy is just failing. We need to have a new one.
What will happen is that basic income will be brought in by the powers that be, but on their terms. Yeah. We're going to make you participate in elections by giving you basic income. We won't give you a basic income if you don't, you know, take the jobs we offer you, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, working for our little oligarch over here, and if you walk away from him, even though he's a bit of a fascist, we're going to cut your benefits off.
Well, that's right. I mean, the benefit system has always been used to coerce poor people. And it could still be used to coerce poor people, even if it was reformed into being a universal basic income.
I find this all fascinating, because it seems to be moving towards this world where money is used to just simply control people in a rather
cynical, evil fashion.
Well, I think after the Second World War, there was a lot more, people had more cash in their pockets, most people had a job, you could walk in and out of jobs easily. Now what's happened really ever since the 1980s, is that, you know, you've got this mass unemployed and we need to find something for them to do. Why don't you just give them land? Give them somewhere to grow their own food. Give them their own home. Give them a few solar panels on their roof. People can get on with it. But they're being deliberately impoverished, aren't they? People are being made landless, made impoverished, so that they're forced into this, you know, financial trap, basically.
In developing countries, redistribution of land is definitely an important, because they can't afford things like universal basic income in places like India, but they can afford land reform.
And if people own their own homes, they look after them much better than a rented home, etc. Nobody seems to be talking about that, which is a long-term solution.
The problem with owner occupation in this country is it's subsidised, and that means some people benefit from it and others do not.
Necessarily. Have to be. Anyway, I think the whole idea of universal basic income is going to have to come down the right line, for good or ill.
The question is, who's going to shape it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we need to do that.
Like everything else, it's who's in charge of it.
I think what you said about, or was it me that said it, about the idea that it should be absolutely guaranteed and it can't be taken away. That's the basic thing, so that you can walk away from a job. And if that starts happening, we've got a little bit of human freedom. But then, of course, you know, the problem is you're always being tied into that financial system, and most people just want to kind of not be absolutely beholden to their credit card and to the government giving them money every month, because that's taking away your power.
Yeah. Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, in earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive them that trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever.
I'm not afraid to die.
1977, When I Were a Lad, fantastic tune. We were all listening to that at school going, wow, who are this lot? But of course, they were giving us quite a horrid message, weren't they? And they were right. All the decent role models seem to have been destroyed since then. They just all we get on the news is the next one's dead, another one's dead, and they seem to be cancelled. The heroes cancelled. So that's The Stranglers from 1977. Before that, from 98, it's Karen Ramirez, Looking for Love. And before that, it's the band is called Ocean from 1971. Put Your Hand in the Hand. Welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling, plunging straight in to the big news of the week. It really is the big news, which is this dam, Martin. Very interesting, I think, the way that there was some very strange videos being shown on British television, produced by the Ukrainians, apparently, or maybe some American marketing firm or British marketing firm for the Ukrainians, showing Ukrainian soldiers in different parts, you know, with different in different roles, fading from one to the next in these kind of dark rooms and etc., putting a finger up to their mouth. Shh, this is the great offensive, but we're not saying anything about it. And then suddenly the dam. It was because I think the reason they weren't saying anything about it is because actually the Ukrainians are getting killed at a horrific rate as part of this offensive, with loads of these Leopard tanks that the Germans have supplied to them not lasting 5 minutes. The Russians have made mincemeat of them, which is why they want to keep their mouths shut and don't want to talk about it, maybe.
Yeah, I think the other thing that's Simplicius the Thinker, whose stuff I follow, has been saying is they don't want to say anything about this offensive until it's has succeeded, and if it succeeds, they'll then say, yes, that was the offensive. But if it fails, they don't want to say anything about it. And that the dam break, there's various theories floating around about what happened with the dam break, but what it certainly does is it knocks the Ukrainian offensive, whether it's winning or losing, off the news cycle. So it gives, and of course the Ukrainians are claiming that the Russians destroyed their own dam because they were in control of the dam. But, of course, the Ukrainians have already been firing at the dam in order to try and do damage it, as has been firing at the nuclear reactor in order to try and damage it. And the other thing that's significant is that the Ukrainians control upriver of the dam, and they have been releasing large amounts of water from upriver to make the dam as full as possible before it broke. And, of course, it's definitely the Russian-controlled part on the Russian side of the river where the flooding is the worst.
Well, that just could be incompetence or the fact of the matter is the Russians are the ones that are advancing, not the Ukrainians.
Well, they're mostly defending, let's put it that way. The Ukrainians have been attacking them the last 48 hours and they've taken huge casualties, as you say. But the Russians are basically going very slowly. You know, you can see they haven't captured any large amounts of territory for many, many months.
Mahmut?
Yes, well, that was a battle of attrition.
A couple of weeks ago, wasn't
it? Yes,
I
know, but that's a battle of attrition. They were drawing in the Ukrainian reserves and mashing them up. Because the ultimate goal of the Russians is to destroy the Ukrainian army. It's not to capture bits of territory. They destroy the Ukrainian army, then they can go wherever they want in the Ukraine if it comes down to it. And if these attacks are being carried out purely for political reasons, to keep Biden and Rishi and all the rest of them happy. But they don't make any military sense. They're just being mashed to pieces because they haven't got air superiority. So all these tanks are just sitting targets, really. And the whole thing is, a totally pointless throw of the dice. And I understand from reading stuff this morning.
It's not pointless. Look, it's not pointless. From
a military point of view.
Even if it's just from a propaganda point of view.
All right, yes, I'm just saying from a military point of view, all that's happening is their final reserves are being decimated. They're not going to. They haven't taken any serious territory.
Well, you keep saying that, but then there seem to be more reserves.
The point is the Russian army is just going through all of their reserves. And that takes quite a long time.
The Ukrainian army?
The Russian army are going through the Ukrainian army's reserves. And every time they attack like this, they're taking far higher casualties than they were before. And, you know, it's not, it's knocking out all of their, you know, these are the NATO-trained units which were supposedly going to swing the side of the battle. And what I was reading this morning, of course, it's all, you know, it's all happening news. We don't know what's really going on, is that they haven't even managed to get through the first defensive line. So they've just been stopped in the minefields and they've been wiped out.
Yeah, so it's very sad to see, isn't it?
It's a total waste.
There are some of the casualty estimates suggesting that up to 40 Ukrainians dying for every one Russian in this
if you're,
supposed great counteroffensive.
Well, the thing is, that the problem with all offensives, certainly in modern warfare, is you're going to take very heavy casualties, which is why the Russians have been very sparing, and they haven't gone for big thrusts forward. They've captured the bits of the Ukraine which they said they were going to take, apart from Kherson City itself, which was on the wrong side of the river, which they had to evacuate because otherwise, if the dam had broken, they'd have all been trapped.
By the glorious Brits, they've been forced to actually take further territory because of these longer range missiles that we're supplying to Ukrainians.
Well, that's what they've been saying they may do. Once the Ukrainian army is destroyed, the Russian army can go where they want in the Ukraine. They may decide that they're going to take Odessa and drive on through to Transnistria, but they're not going to try and do that until the Ukrainian army has been comprehensively smashed, because otherwise lots of Russian boys will die and their mums will be unhappy.
Aren't the US Navy SEALs and the SAS going to stop them?
No, they are not. The British SAS and SBS are well embedded into what's going on in the Ukraine, just as they are in the Yemen. But the kind of tactics they have been pursuing, assassination of journalists, attacks on the Kerch Bridge that killed 3 civilians, incursions across the border into Russia, which gets smashed supposedly by Russian far-right forces who are opposed to Putin. This has got the fingerprints of the Brits all over it, in my view. But of course, it's that we do not fight the kind of big war that the Russians are fighting now. We couldn't do it under any circumstances. We just haven't got the people, the kit, the strategic doctrine, nothing. So we're left with what is essentially terrorist tactics. But the Russians, you know, that's the weapon of the weak. They can't, you know, there's no way that NATO, what's becoming absolutely clear is there is no way that NATO armed forces can stand up to the Russians.
It's not every day that I clap my hands for BBC Verify ever since they started a week or so ago. But they did actually put out a brilliant report that I thought this week, which was a bit of info from a satellite company that showed this dam actually being with only a small hole in it last Thursday. So it looked as if there'd been maybe an artillery shell had landed on the dam. But what it had done is it had done enough damage to just make it so that the water is overflowing the dam with a few metres or a few yards of water where there should have been a road. In fact, not a lot of damage, but what seems to have happened over the weekend is bit by bit, the water has been dislodging masonry as it's flowing across, and the burst has got gradually worse and worse and worse. Yet we didn't hear anything about this until Tuesday, so it had the effect of saying, well, almost as if the Thursday, Friday, Saturday and Sunday and Monday didn't happen. So 6 days, this damn breach was getting worse and worse and worse, but we didn't hear anything about that. It was made out as if it was all some big thing that happened on Tuesday, which it wasn't.
Well, I've been reading about this, and we're trying to make timelines and so on. But I understand that the Norwegian, they've got a Norwegian station in Ukraine, which is there to check for nuclear tests. And they said that there was a big explosion at the dam. So that, in other words, there's three theories. Either the Russians blew it up, the Ukrainians blew it up, or it just went down, it just collapsed because it was old and
we can't necessarily trust the Norwegians. They're just part of NATO.
No,
they will say what they're supposed to say, if they get orders to say some X, then because they want to put it on the
news. Well, we know that
the
Ukrainians have already fired HIMARS at the dam. They have. And the reason why the Russians withdrew from Kherson when Surovikin took over was they knew that if the dam was burst, their troops on the wrong side of the river would then be, they couldn't extract them.
Okay, so who did it and why?
Well, I don't know who did it, but I suspect the Ukrainians did it, as they certainly, you know, the Americans did the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. The Ukrainians will probably have done the dam because it's a way of winning sympathy in the West. Oh, look, our dam's been blown up by the terrible Russians.
Well,
help
you know
us,
what
please.
Makes me very suspicious, really, really, really suspicious, and that's the appearance of certain Mr. Yatsenyuk on the BBC on Tuesday morning to explain exactly what had happened. Now, do you want to say something about him?
Well, yes.
I haven't seen him for a couple of years as a spokesperson for Ukraine. Suddenly he's
Yatsenyuk
there.
Yatsenyuk was, you know, he's basically... He was the guy that was put in charge of Ukraine after the coup in 2014 by Victoria Nuland. So,
far right, about as far right Nazi as you can get.
Well,
really.
He's basically a finance person from the West, effectively. And Klitschko, the European Union wanted to put Klitschko in power in Kiev after the massacre in the Maidan Square, but. Victoria Nuland famously phoned up at the US ambassador and said, F the EU, we're going to... Yats is the guy, because he's the American...
He's the CIA guy they wanted to take over the country.
That's right.
So he is the guy. He's also... He was in charge. He was chairman of the National Security Council the day MH17 came down. You know, this Malaysian airliner. Yeah. Very interesting character. He seems to be the guy that thinks he can get away with everything and anything. And he resigned 2 weeks, with no explanation, 2 weeks after the Malaysian airliner was brought down.
Well, yeah, you can speculate how much he was involved in that.
Well, he certainly can. You know, there's a lot of...
I mean, Russia...
I just think it's important to point out that this is massively contested, even by the Malaysians, as to what actually happened who shot that aircraft down.
One crucial piece of evidence is that BBC Russia, which employs Russian correspondents, had people on the ground soon after it was shot down, and they got eyewitness testimonies from people saying it was shot down by a Kiev plane, and that's what took it down. There was no evidence of a Buk missile, total fabrication. But of course, many people believe that a Buk missile fired by a Russian unit. Of course, there were no Russian Buk missiles in the Ukraine at that time. They'd have had to have been driven in from Russia and then extracted back to Russia. But of course, there were 7 Buk batteries in Ukraine, Ukrainian ones. And, of course, the evidence shows that it was probably shot down by a fighter jet. And of course, it was redirected by air traffic control in Kiev into the war zone. So when people go, isn't it terrible these rebels have shot down this? It's probably NATO intelligence services who shot down that plane and killed everybody on board. They're the ones who should be going to court.
Or maybe just the Ukrainian Air Force, because...
They won't have done that stuff without clearing it with their handlers.
Well, most possibly, but Ukrainian pilot blamed... This is from March 2018, 4 years after the plane came down. I think maybe a couple of years. I'm sorry, I'm not sure which year that was. But anyway, the Ukrainian pilot blamed by Russia for the MH17 crash kills himself. This is a guy called Captain Vladislav Voloshin. Vladislav, V-O-L-O-S-H-Y-N, called the Russian allegation a lie. A Dutch investigator concluded that a Russian Buk missile destroyed the Boeing jet, killing 298 people. A Dutch investigator from NATO decided that. So apparently Voloshin shot himself at his home in Mykolaiv near the Black Sea. He'd flown 33 combat missions in a low-flying Su-25 ground attack jet that day, apparently. But of course he didn't shoot the plane down. So interesting that he should kill himself, isn't it? So anyway, Yatsenyuk is what we're really talking about here. This coup plotter, very much involved with the CIA in taking over Ukraine and to destroying the democratically elected government that there was at the time in 2014. So wasn't it interesting to hear him pop up on the BBC? So I think we should have a little listen to the report the BBC did, where this guy Yatsenyuk pops up magically to tell us exactly what happened. And of course, we can trust him. BBC Verify didn't really do a fact check like I just did about how trustworthy Yatsenyuk is.
This video, which was tweeted by Mr. Zelensky, shows the breached Nova Kakhovka hydroelectric dam. He says the shelling of the dam only confirms for the whole world that the Russians must be expelled from every corner of Ukrainian land. However, the two sides are blaming each other for blowing up the dam, which is near Kherson, with potentially deadly consequences for communities downstream. Now, these images come from Korabel, which is downstream, and it shows flooding that has taken place of homes, garages, and agricultural land. This is part of a residential area as well. The Russian installed mayor of the town immediately next to the dam says that the water level there could rise by up to 12 meters. Well, the former Prime Minister of Ukraine, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, gave us his reaction to the unfolding situation around the dam on the Dnipro River.
You know, this is another part of the Russian military tactics and strategy against Ukraine. This comprises everything, including humanitarian disasters and catastrophe and the man-made disasters that Russia inflicted on Ukraine. You know, it resembles me the letter of Nazi leader Himmler that he sent in 1943 to then governor, so-called governor of Ukraine, when they were retreating from the Ukrainian territory. In his letter, he said that, look, we need to leave a scorched earth in Ukraine, kill everything, including even animals. So Putin and his policy is a copycat scenario of Nazi policy. And this constitutes definitely an international and war crime, and this is in complete violation with the Article 56 of Geneva Convention. But Putin doesn't care about the international law. What he cares about his imperialistic, stupid thinking and ideas, how to take over Ukraine and how to restore the Soviet Union. So this is a huge disaster and another challenge for Ukraine and another threat for the entire world.
And that was the former Prime Minister of Ukraine, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, speaking to me earlier.
Well, in the immortal words of Mandy Rice Davis, he would say that, wouldn't he? Just can't people see how convoluted that argument is? He's comparing Putin to Hitler. Now, Putin may be many things, but Hitler he is not. The Russian population regard the other side as the inheritors of the Hitlerian role. And, of course, Yatsenyuk, being a Western-trained psychological warfare specialist, is just trying to muddy the waters there, quite literally. I think it's more than likely that the Russians withdrew their forces from Kherson because they feared that the blowing up of the bridge would leave them exposed with no supply lines. And don't forget, the Russians control the dam, so if they wanted to flood the downstream area, they could just release the sluice gates. They don't have to blow it up. The only people who've got a motive, means and opportunity to blow it up are the Ukrainians, because and their whole strategy from the very beginning has been to create big lies, such as we were talking earlier about gaming platforms, the Ghost of Kiev, which was taken from a video game, and the Ukrainian psychological warfare people with their British advisors were banging it all around on the internet that this was a brave Ukrainian pilot who was shooting down scores of Russian planes every day. They knew it was a lie, and they even boasted about it afterwards, saying, well, it was a lie, but it was a really useful lie because it helped morale. They even said that. And then we're supposed to take them seriously when they come out with stuff like this.
OK, so Yatsenyuk's government, which was the first formed after the coup, included a whole load of Svoboda ministers. So he was quite interesting. It's interesting, isn't it, that he's accusing Putin of being a Nazi. Well, actually, there's much more evidence that this Svoboda party, which he's favouring and making sure that he gives them key government ministries, they are actually Nazis.
Well, Svoboda were told to change their name to Svoboda, which means freedom, from the Social National Party of Ukraine, which had definitely fascist roots. Now, Yatsenyuk is the Western frontman for what goes on in Ukraine, as Zelensky has become. But the armed forces and the Azov battalions, because there's more than one of them, these are paramilitary right-wing groups who've been trained by the British Army. Yeah, it's like the British Army training the Ku Klux Klan or the UDA, and of course they did, in fact, work with the UDA, as we know. This whole war in Ukraine is becoming a horrifying spectacle. And, you know, the damage is... There should have been a negotiated solution in spring of last year. It was on the table. It was brokered by the Turks and the Israelis. It could, all of this could have been settled. We're in this mess.
So first of all, the BBC put this neo-Nazi on Yatsenyuk, a CIA coup plotter, accusing Putin of being a Nazi, when actually it certainly looks as if he's much more of a pro-Nazi kind of person than Putin. And then they have a report with their correspondent in the region, James Waterhouse.
Our Ukraine correspondent James Waterhouse has more from Kyiv.
According to Ukrainian officials, water levels will reach a critical level in the next couple of hours. Now, we know they are evacuating thousands of people from settlements right along the river towards the southern city of Kherson, but only on the western bank of the river, which it controls, because this is also a front line on the eastern bank. That is land occupied by Russia, which controls the Kakhovka Dam. They were accused of laying it with explosives last year, which it denied. And Kyiv once again blames Moscow for being responsible for the scenes we are seeing this morning. Now, we can't definitively say who is responsible, but in a military sense, it computes more for Russia to have carried this out. Why? Well, Ukraine is starting its counter-offensive step by step, and this is an area which Russian forces have been preparing for some kind of Ukrainian offensive. Blowing this dam up takes out a major crossing point, and it also widens the river itself, but the collateral damage is huge. People in occupied Crimea to the south have also been cut off from water supplies or are in danger of being cut off. And then you have the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant upstream, also controlled by Russian forces, which rely on the river's water to cool its six reactors. So the collateral damage is vast, but nevertheless, this is connected to the early stages of Ukraine's much-anticipated counteroffensive.
And that was James Waterhouse with an update from Kyiv. Let's cross live now to Singapore and Samir Puri, who is visiting lecturer in war studies at King's College London and also the author of the book Russia's Road to War with Ukraine. Thank you and welcome to the programme, Mr. Puri. Let's talk about the strategic advantage, or rather disadvantage, for both sides in destroying this dam.
Great. Well, thanks very much for having me. Well, undoubtedly, this is a move that benefits the Russians because they are bracing for this Ukrainian counteroffensive. And the idea is to make as difficult as possible any Ukrainian river crossing that the Ukrainians might want to make, because you've got the Ukrainians on one side of the river, the Russians on the other side. And the strategic value of destroying this bridge is that this is not a very well-bridged river. In fact, the only other bridge, the Antonivsky Bridge, that crosses the river, was destroyed last year in the conflict. So this is going to make Ukraine's strategic calculations for assaulting across the river very challenging indeed.
So there you go, Martin. This is the correspondent and the expert, plus Yatsenyuk himself, all pointing the finger at Russia.
Well, I've got an open mind about this, but you, as he pointed out, for example, the blowing up of the dam, if it was blown up, cuts off the water supply to Crimea. And one of the goals of the Russian special military operation was to take the dam so that they could resupply Crimea with water. So, you know, that you'd have thought that that would make them very unwilling to blow it up and therefore put the Crimeans in a position where they've got no access to water for agriculture, for example.
One thing I will do is I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk some of the information about this counteroffensive and the casualties, because that's one thing that this is designed to obscure, isn't it?
I would guess that would be my hunch about what this is about. They got clobbered on the first 2 days of their counteroffensive, and they've blown the dam as a way of distracting attention from the fact that they're going nowhere. What Simplicissimus is saying is also, in fact, the Ukrainians would also have an advantage of blowing the dam there, because then they can move their forces elsewhere. Yeah, nobody can cross the river now, not for several weeks, probably.
Never mind with messing around with the news on the news. What about this morning? I found this absolutely incredible. I think it's going to be really good next week to hear the Culture, Media and Sport Committee grilling the bosses of ITV, because the actual editor of This Morning, I've never seen, got such a kind of creepy feeling from some sort of psycho running This Morning. His name is, his editor is Martin Frizzell, and he was asked a very simple question: is there a toxic culture this week at This Morning? And he came up with what is just can only be described as a toxic answer. He's not answering the question. Imagine if you had to work for this guy. He's not straight talking. He's not telling the truth. He's not up front. The guy's a creep, and he certainly shouldn't be in charge of editing a nice little cosy family programme like This Morning, which clearly has a toxic culture with a personality like this you're about to hear in charge.
Mr. Frizzell, is there a toxic work environment in This Morning?
Sorry?
Is there a toxic work environment at This Morning?
I'll tell you what's toxic.
I've always found toxic.
Is aubergine? Do you like aubergine? Do you?
Is there a toxic work environment?
But do you like aubergine? Because I don't like aubergine. It's just a personal thing.
Is there a toxic work environment at This Morning?
It's a really
sir?
Big day today, though, because John Turode's back. The spicy barbecue prawns. Josie, Adam Lambert, Joe Joyner, and Holly Willoughby. See you at 10. Thank you.
Yeah, what a creep. It won't ask a very basic question about safeguarding on his programme. Martin, this is the kind of guy, you know, he comes across as a manipulative, actually, very manipulative bloke. And, of course, that's not what you want on a nice little friendly family show with the kids watching, etc.
Well, I'm aware of this controversy, but since I don't watch it and I've got very little interest in the people involved... I've been reading stuff about the dam, Tony.
Yeah. Well, so what I'm saying is about the media, yeah, because it's not... What I'm saying, suggesting here is it's not just the news media that's being manipulated. There's some weird character who comes across like some kind of weird psycho and can't answer a straight question and manipulates it towards aubergines. You know, he's so smart. I'm just thinking this is the guy that you want to walk away from if you were in a job, isn't it?
Well, yes, it's a facetious answer, isn't it? If the police were asked, is there a toxic culture in the police, they wouldn't start talking about aubergines. They'd have to come up with something a bit better than that, wouldn't
better,
they?
Yeah, well, I mean, it just gives you an idea. I think I remember on one of the late-night live comedy programmes, I think it was Jonathan Powell, they were talking about the toxic culture in Westminster, and Jonathan Powell said, yeah, well, what about the toxic culture in the mass media? What about that? And, of course, there is an incredibly toxic... You know, people have a great dream of working for TV, etc., and then when they actually get there, they find the whole place is like it's vile.
Well, in Parliament, I can't remember the number of MPs that are under investigation for sexual harassment, but it's a lot. Scores.
So, one of the, I mean, the theme last week, and I'm going to carry on a little bit this week, is this amazing stuff that, you know, you see these Bilderbergers, and then they suddenly come out on the news talking about all these things that, all the topics which are being discussed at Bilderberg, then get rolled out right across the world's press. And I just find it incredible that, you know, all the little silly things that we're talking about and discussing at Bilderberg in the week or so after the conference, or even a couple of weeks, suddenly start dominating the agenda. We've now got this AI conference being put together in the UK. And as a sort of Bilderberg debrief, I spoke to Helen Borno. I was over, she's a photographer, married to Charlie Skelton, over in Portugal, about the incredible concentration of people involved with artificial intelligence over at Bilderberg this year.
If we don't know what's going on in there, what's the point of covering it?
Well, we see so much. We just, there's people attending, you know, maybe not absolutely in the conference room, but they're certainly staying in the hotel and having meetings, who aren't on the list that the group puts out. We see it's just good to know it's happening. We need to say, well, this is a NATO summit. Look at all of it, you know. Jens Stoltenberg is there, you know, the Allied Supreme Commander of Europe is there, Christopher Cavoli, that, you know, all of these politicians are there, these European politicians. you know, this is happening. This is newsworthy.
We know they're there, but we don't really know what they're saying. Although they do publish a list of gender items, don't they? And one of the fun things about Bilderberg, and I find this every time I visit, is that you see this sort of cascade all over the international press for a couple of weeks afterwards, often relating to specific individuals who were there, obviously talking about what they were talking about in there, but they're not allowed to make any reference to Bilderberg. I mean, for example, this time, the big one for me was Eric Schmidt, the former Google boss, saying that artificial intelligence could... mean that humanity goes extinct. Now, obviously, this is the sort of stuff they're talking about in there. It's on the list. He's on the list.
Sam Altman as well just tweeted just a couple of days afterwards, very productive week of conversations in Europe about how best to regulate AI! Exclamation mark. So in May 26th, he tweeted that, so just after... the meeting, just a few days after the meeting. Sam Altman, the head of OpenAI, ChatGPT, and obviously we had Demis Hassabis there, who Google DeepMind, Sam Altman, Eric Schmidt, who else? Peter Thiel, Alex Karp of Palantir. This is the creme de la creme of AI kind of people, and they were all there with all these hedge fund people, all these EU commissioners, well, two EU commissioners, talking about how to regulate AI at this supposedly private meeting full of just private individuals. It's the deep state merging with the political class and the policy makers and their cozy relationship, and how this year it seemed to be very militaristic. It was a lot about Ukraine. Yeah. Don't forget AI and military, that overlap is key. For example, Alex Karp of Palantir was the first CEO to visit Zelensky, and they run, the AI and the drones and the targeting in Ukraine.
Well, of the Russians,
And Alex Karp just recently went to a baseball game with Rishi Sunak, by the way. And now the UK is hosting the AI regulation summit.
Something I think key thing to understand about all of this is the way that the Chatham House rules work, Martin. This is, I think, even some of the participants on our discussion on Patrick Henningsen's Twitter space just after the conference didn't really understand that it's not that you can't talk about it as much as you want, but you can't make any reference to who said what, and you can't make any reference to the Bilderbergers themselves. So, obviously there's loads of NATO people there. There's senior military people from the US meeting loads of European politicians. Obviously they're talking about war. Charlie, quite rightly, I think, talked about it as a warmongering. Basically, and the reason AI is involved is because suddenly the chickens are coming home to roost. AI is being deployed in Ukraine, and potentially is going to be used if this conflict spreads wider to a Russia NATO conflict.
Well, obviously, anything we say about this is speculative because we weren't there. But
that isn't speculative. We know for a fact that AI is being used with Palantir, yeah. Alex Karp's company, now, right this minute, quite how it's working. This is basically a trial run for it, and they're using the Ukrainians as a test bed for this new technology to kill Russians.
Well, that's a reasonable presumption.
It was in the news at Christmas time, 2022. Yeah.
I think the problem for the AI people in the Ukraine is this, that it's all dependent on satellites, and at some point the Russians could just shoot them all down, and therefore you'll be then fighting blind. Nobody wants to do that because it will create a load of space junk which will be there forever. But if we're going to blow up dams, maybe we could destroy all the ionosphere satellites
maybe
as well.
Maybe not forever. We might have space dust carts.
Well, yes, but I mean, the point is that the real danger of this is it's going to escalate out of control completely, because the West doesn't know how to extract itself from what it started here. The only thing they know how to do is to keep escalating. And that way potentially lies a disastrous miscalculation.
With
by
all
one
of this
side or the other.
Peace and war stuff, I mean, it's quite obvious to me that Bilderberg is a very important interface of the war machine with politics in the NATO countries. And if anyone that can't see that, you're blind. But it reminded me of a conversation I had with a German called Klaus Kopf. He was at the Dresden meeting in 2016, and he gave me this incredible tale about how when he was at the War and Peace Institute in Hamburg, just studying as a young student, he wanted to do his thesis on the Bilderbergers, and this is the treatment that he got. But he also then, afterwards, he went, and as not part of his studies in Hamburg, went to meet the secretary of one of the very first German Bilderbergers. A fantastic tale, and very indicative of the betrayal of what they're actually supposed to be doing of some of our academics.
My name is Klaus Kopf from Hamburg, and I'm here at my first Bilderberg meeting because I tried in 1995 to do my final exams on the Bilderberg topic.
Now, you were advised by one of your professors, I believe, not to do Bilderberg.
Well, it was actually not exactly my professor, it was a professor, and he was the director of the Hamburg Institute for Peace and Security Studies. He was the successor of Mr. Egon Bahr, foreign minister in the government of Willy Brandt. And as Egon Bahr attended a meeting of Bilderberg in 1971, I knew Egon Bahr would have some knowledge about this meeting. And so I asked Professor Dieter Lutz if he could ask, instead of me, because I was just too afraid to do this job, if he would have any knowledge on Bilderberg that he could share. And so, yes, Mr. Lutz agreed to ask him, and that's what he did. And he came back 3 days later after the weekend and told me then that Mr. Egon Bahr said, well, there are three good reasons for this young guy not to work on this Bilderberg topic on his final papers. First reason, if he is interested in a career as a political scientist, this career will be ended before it just began, because I would have worked on this Bilderberg topic. Second, as billions are somehow handled at Bilderberg, and as they would decide on peace and war, he will not find out anything about Bilderberg, so there's no good reason to work on something you will not find out anything about. And third reason not to work on Bilderberg is, if I would find out something, I would have to cope with personal problems. So I was, like, shocked. I knew there would be a kind of a conspiracy theory around Bilderberg. But to hear this from a professor was like a shock. And I screamed at him and said, well, you are the director at the Institute in Hamburg on peace and security research, which is not just some institute in the world. It's one of the top five institutes in the world. And you've never heard until Friday, when I asked you for Bilderberg, you've never heard about Bilderberg before. And now, on Monday, you just say that Egon Bahr said they would decide on peace and war at these conferences. And you've never heard about Bilderberg before. And now I ask you, are you serious? Who is paying you for your research work, which, as you don't even know that Bilderberg exists and where peace and war is done? And I was screaming, and in the middle of the sentence, my voice broke off, and he recognized this moment, and now he screamed at me and said, you blue-eyed asshole, do you really believe, you naive asshole, do you really believe the American president, he is voted? Are you serious? Where do you live? Where do you live? I said, that's where we are? Oh yes, that's where we are! I was totally shocked of this situation. That was one of the most significant moments in my research on Bilderberg.
Yeah, I think you did. You must have touched a nerve, I think. It sounds like you touched a very important nerve. But anyhow, I know you also made an attempt to track down one of the original German Bilderberg participants, and that's not easy because, you know, they've all died. But you managed to find his secretary. Who was that guy?
Well, it was Rudolf Müller, and for really a long time I bumped into this name. Pretty soon, he and Max Brauer the mayor of Hamburg, Max Brauer and Rudolf Müller, that these two guys represented Germany at the first meeting in 1954. So Max Brauer was easy, as being from Hamburg, but Rudolf Müller always just read that he would be a lawyer from Frankfurt, but I had no clue whom Rudolf Müller would be. So after I've been to several archives, I finally found out that Rudolf Müller was the president of the Wirtschaftspolitische Gesellschaft in Frankfurt, that he was co-founder of the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, which is one of the major newspapers in Germany, and that he was in the board of several big companies in Germany, and that before that he was finance minister after the Second World War in 1947 in the so-called B zone. So it was those two zones occupied by the Americans and the British. After I found out that whom Rudolf Müller actually was, I asked at the WePop if there does exist an archive about Rudolf Müller, which didn't exist. And I asked, does there still live someone who personally knew Rudolf Müller? And it's mentioned, yeah, there is this woman, Miss Käthe Koch, living in Frankfurt still. That was back in 2004, I think. And so they gave me her phone number and called her. And she was really shocked when I asked her on Bilderberg, because Mr. Rudolf Müller denied her to work on Bilderberg in any way. But she was his personal secretary for years. And all these papers for the different boards he worked for. But she was never allowed to work on Bilderberg. So she remembered well Bilderberg, the expression, the name. But she also mentioned, I'm very sorry, but I cannot help you at all. So I asked her, I would be in Frankfurt anyways in 2 weeks if I could give you a visit, and she agreed. And 2 weeks later I came to Frankfurt. She invited me for a cup of tea and had some cookies, and then she said, listen, for 2 weeks I made up my mind on Bilderberg, and yes, it was something that I can actually give you. Because that time I was, it must have been back in late May 1954, she said, which was funny, when you know that the first Bilderberg meeting is took place in late May 54 in Oosterbeek, in Netherlands. So she remembered also in May 54, two men came to her office, or to the office of Rudolf Müller, in the case of Bilderberg. So I asked her, whom were those two persons? And she said, well, the one was the Archbishop of Cologne, Mr. Frings, and the second one was Otto Jung, who was the Verfassungsschutzpräsident, so it was kind of the head of the intelligence service in Germany. Yeah, well, that was quite shocking to have the Vatican involved directly before the first meeting even happened. Yeah.
Well, isn't that fascinating? I find it. I mean, I think it's amazing, that little bit of work that Klaus did there. First of all, showing up his intellectual so-called professor bosses at the Peace and Security Center in Hamburg to be basically war collaborators sworn to secrecy. And then to see the MI5 guy from Germany, plus, amazingly, this Joseph Frings, Cardinal Frings, who was the Catholic Bishop of Cologne right the way through the war, that Nazis didn't touch him. And then suddenly there he is after the war saying, come along to the very first Bilderberg. Now, we know the Catholic Church was involved in those Nazi rat lines too, Martin. So amazing work there, I think, by Klaus. I mean, what do you make of this? The links between the Bilderbergers and the Catholic Church, the links with the internal security service in Germany, and I suppose also the betrayal by these academics. They're saying, well, actually, you know, you've hit on a subject which is the most important in this field, and the last thing we want you to do is study it.
Well, I mean, it's quite clear that these Bilderberg meetings are elite networking opportunities. So the fact that there are archbishops and heads of intelligence services there is hardly, it's hardly news to our audience.
These were the people that were turned up at his office and said, we would like you to come to this meeting, please. So they weren't actually at the meeting themselves.
So, I mean, the history of Bilderberg is obviously a fascinating topic. And it's obviously a taboo topic, because for many years, as you know, they denied they even existed, which, of course, you know, they can hardly do that now. And of course, insofar as they are in the public eye now, it may well be that decisions are made elsewhere where we don't know where they're meeting. It's not just a meeting. It's one of the meetings that the elites have to align their various
interests. And it's much more than that, isn't it? It's a total betrayal for all of those media and democratic politicians, our representatives that go in there. They're betraying the people that voted them in when they walk through the door and swear to secrecy,
well,
aren't they?
Yeah, I think that is an issue. If you go as an elected politician to Bilderberg, you ought to give a report on what was said.
Or what about as a journalist?
Or as a journalist. And the fact that they can't means that that this is inherently an undemocratic setup, isn't it?
Two very important arms of our freedoms, aren't they? Democracy and the free press. So both of them turning their back on.
Yes, but as the professor pointed out to his naive student, that's not how the world works.
He was a bit naive, maybe, but I mean, he was actually courageous, and he had the courage of his convictions to take his professor on.
Yes. But you can imagine the professor in a more senior position who knows which side his bread's buttered on. He's not having one of his spotty little students getting him into trouble, is he? If you don't think that's the way the world works, I've got a suspension bridge to sell.
Yeah, well, you must see, Martin, the significance of the academics betraying their profession effectively too.
They've all got mortgages, Tony, and kids,
And they've sworn secret oaths that they will never talk about they will protect their criminal friends at the expense of their profession.
Yes.
I would suggest with the politicians and the academics particularly, and the journalists too, they are sworn to secrecy, that they will that their loyalty is not to their profession, it's to a secret club, a cabal that's now actually driving Britain. I mean, we'll see what happens at this Vilnius NATO summit to World War III.
Well, quite possibly, yes. I mean, the situation is very, very tense and potentially catastrophic. Don't forget that the Russians still aren't happy about these short-range missiles in Poland and Romania. And they may decide that they're going to take those out. The British, I mean, they've been basically pointing the finger at the British, saying, we think you're behind various terrorist attacks in Russia. So, you know, and the assassination of Zakhachenko in 2017, he was the elected Prime Minister of the Donbass Republic. Obviously, Prime Ministers are legitimate targets, Rishi.
Let's end on a little bit of a positive note. The Republican Senators have introduced something in the United States Senate called the End Endless Wars Act. At least somebody somewhere is saying this has got to stop.
Well, I'll believe it when I see it, because the funders of the Republican Party are the same arms industry and banks that fund the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
And there's obviously a groundswell of opinion in conservative America that why are we spending this money on this war in the Ukraine when we got things to spend it on back at home?
And do you think...
Which is absolutely logical. I'm totally in favour of people saying that, asking that question.
Do you think it's a good idea for the Chinese to set up a spy base in Cuba? Is it really going to happen?
Well, I don't know whether they have or they haven't, but I mean, it's not really for the West to tell the Cubans what they can and can't do, is it? I mean, in any case, if we're going to be allowed to put missiles into Poland and Romania, maybe the Chinese should put some missiles in Cuba to deter the Americans from invasion.
Surely this is a reaction to what's been going on in Taiwan, isn't it?
It quite possibly is. I mean, the Chinese basically have been trying to, as the Russians were, have been trying to avoid conflict with the United States because they're the economies are intertwined and it doesn't make any rational sense to have a fight to the finish.
The Lords of Chaos seem to be doing quite well.
Well, they do, but of course the consequences are potentially disastrous.
So we'll finish this week, thanks Martin, with a little excerpt from a documentary. I'll put a link up to that on our show pages, also at thisweek.org.uk. Fascinating, I think, interviews with Satanists. The documentary is called Hail Satan.
We will begin with Lucian. All right, Lucian. So is it like Lucian as in Lucifer? Is that why you're called that?
Sure, as you like.
Well, that's not as you like. I don't, like, is that your birth name?
No, it's not.
Okay. So, what is it that first drew you to the Satanic Temple?
Well, I helped co-found the Satanic Temple.
Why?
Why? Because it is an embodiment of my deeply held beliefs, and I think there's a distinct need for a counterbalance against the dominant religious privilege in America today.
What are the deeply held beliefs that drew you to the Satanic Temple?
Essentially, we view Satan as a symbolic embodiment of the ultimate rebel against tyranny.
Once you realize how the media is constructed, it becomes incredibly easy to manipulate.
Good evening to you at 6 o'clock. I'm Chip Scarborough. Well, the owner of a Meridian cemetery has already said he plans to pursue charges against members of New York's Satanic Temple. And now police are investigating the unusual ritual.
This you have to see to believe. A group of devil worshippers giving Westboro Baptist Church a run for their money.
God hates fags. Except you repent, you shall all likewise perish. And God is not running out of room in hell.
No, certainly isn't. I did say a few months ago we should be doing more, and of course the mainstream press should too, of these near-death experiences. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, also writer and researcher Dr. Judith Brown, and sound engineer Dave Bozenko. Download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Do please send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find the podcast, full-length interviews, story links, comment page, and our email addresses. I've done two books. That's this week, oneword.org.uk. I've done two books. One is a compilation, which is called The Siege of Heaven Reader, which is looking at secret government, and basically it's an anthology of all this stuff from right the way back to the English Civil War, plus The Traitors of Arnhem. It's the one about Bilderberg, Martin Bormann and the Bilderbergers. That's £15. And the Siege of Heaven Reader is 20. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream and over Sunday breakfast at camberleysradioquk.com. Do please make live recordings. We've been streaming live from PRSC on the talkradio.org.uk stream and at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream next Friday. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down. Thank you.